This podcast is brought to you by Random House Audio. Experience books like you've never heard them before. Press play.
T-10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
We can confirm.
Ignition. Liftoff.
Liftoff.
All right, everybody, welcome to an excellent edition of Weekend Confirmed as we roll on into September. My name is Garnet Lee. Have a great show lined up for you today. With us is the lead writer from Gearbox Software on Borderlands 2, Mr. Anthony Birch.
Hello.
And also joining us with his T-shirt, which you just would have to see to appreciate, but it's kind of amazing.
Oh, I just now got that.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah,
he had to explain it to me. That would be Mr. Adam Sessler.
Hello, happy birthday.
And to you too, my good man.
That's right, yeah.
A couple of, it's amazing, there are a lot of Virgos around. Who knew?
Yeah,
who knew?
And are we like the tail end of Virgos?
I think we're at the lead edge.
Yeah, I mean, you're right,
we're at one end or the other. I don't remember which one it is.
I think we're at the very, very end. Now, granted, I'm the 29th, which is also shared by Jerry Lewis.
Awesome.
And Michael Jackson. So I like to consider myself rounding out the holy triumvirate of America's favorite entertainers.
Excellent.
I think John McCain's on that, too, but I don't find it very entertaining.
Astrology! It's science! Yay! Hold on, I've got an app for that, too. And then also here with us is Mr. Andrew Yoon, senior editor from Shack News.
I'm a Pisces.
You're a Pisces. Mm-hmm. Also, astrology! Science!
I don't even know. What time of year is Pisces?
It's March.
March-ish. Yeah, my little brother's a Pisces, too.
I guess that's kind of a fishy time of the year.
Well, we've done it all now. Anthony, would you care to share your astrological sign?
Capricorn for life.
Oh, he's a Capricorn.
It is for life. Yeah. Like, you can't really change it.
Not until
you can tell that
machine.
This is a Western podcast because we're doing astrology instead of blood type.
Obviously, exactly.
If we were in Japan, it would be like, oh, I'm AB.
If we did blood types, it might get weird, though. Just be like, oh, my God, we have the same blood type.
I know, right?
Blood brothers, and then just bad things will happen.
I don't think I know my blood type.
You should probably figure that out.
I know, I probably should. I know my wife knows my blood type, and I think I just rely that once I need blood, she'll be nearby.
Right.
So
apparently I have a rare blood type, so whenever I donate blood, they get an extra bag.
And I'm like, oh, excellent.
And I'm like, oh, God.
Do you get two cookies as a result?
I You know how much I can eat.
You get up two bags of cookies.
I go pretty crazy on that.
Adam, if it takes any comfort for you, I don't think I know my blood type either.
And like, if I was wrong, I die, don't I?
Yep.
Yeah.
That's just what happens.
Wow.
Eeny, meeny, miny. Oh, you're dead. Sorry.
I am driving home so slowly from this.
You're like there at the bridge. What is your blood type? A. No, B. Ah! Anyway, all right, we have an excellent show, so we are definitely going to talk some Borderlands 2 today, and there is a whole plethora of other things we have to talk about. Now, it's been a little bit of a slow release week, or last couple of weeks, so we're going to do something we talked about, which is catch up on some games. One of the reasons Adam is here is because he's been playing a couple of games we already tried to go back to a little bit, but I don't think we were extremely successful with. One of them is Sleeping Dogs, which Andrew wrote the review for. And Adam's really enjoyed, so we're going to talk a little bit more about Sleeping Dogs. I like this idea, and a lot of you guys out there listening really like this idea of us coming back and seeing how a game has settled in and not just been the release glow of, oh my God, it's the best thing ever, or oh, that's crap, I hated it. It's awful. I don't want to play it anymore. So we're going to do a little bit of that. We have a ton of news things to look at, and you know, I don't think I can wait any longer, and Mark McDonald would obviously be upset if I did wait any longer before talking about the second coming. And that would be Metal Gear Solid Ground Zeroes.
Ground Zeroes.
Ground Zeroes.
More than one zero.
I think at the end of the day, this is still probably one of the most sensible or cogent names that's been ascribed to a Metal Gear Solid game.
It's more logical than Revengeance, certainly.
Yeah. Or
that's not canonical. That's just a whole little fun thing now. Besides, that's just different.
Yeah,
let's not go into Metal Gear canon. Let's just avoid that conversation altogether.
You see, Big Boss. Actually, that would be a great place for the 8-4 podcast to really get into it. If you want really in-depth, those guys have already talked about this in great detail. I want to talk about it, though, some from this side of the Pacific. Look, it's really impossible to watch that video and not just be bowled over immediately by the fidelity of what they're able to do with it.
No, I've seen a lot of Shaq News commenters being like, oh, that's not that great, you know.
Really?
Yeah, it's really impressive how people really want not to be happy.
I got deep. Shit got real.
People on the internet. No, actually, it's just people on the net.
No, really, like, you read through the comments, and they're like, well, the rain is obviously fake. And I'm like...
So is the game.
Yeah.
It's an artifice.
God damn it, that rain is clearly fake. The entire rest of it, totally real.
Yeah.
Totally 100% real. But that rain, that is so fake.
If each drop of rain is not an individual polygon model, it's useless.
I mean, but you're right. It is a weird way to look at the world. Like, everything is a con. Everything is trying to get something from you. I mean, it's kind of, that's usually an attitude that you give over to, like, a 50-year-old lonely widower somewhere, I don't know, in the outskirts of Oklahoma, who just kind of sees the world through paranoid glasses. It is a little bit strange that, yeah, when you see something as awesome as that, that your first instinct is, well, that was fake.
It's a weird psychological thing I read, that if someone is pessimistic, observers are more likely to assume them intelligent than if somebody's optimistic.
Yes. And that explains the internet.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's a terrible notion. Wow, that's just...
That study's dumb, and I don't believe it. That's
so
smart. I look.
So dumb. So yeah. Ridiculous. I think that, first of all, after you get past the initial... I think it looks great. Like, whoever's commenting that it doesn't look great...
Yeah, they're just wrong.
I would ask them to relax and go back and watch it again, and then think about what other games you've played and how well they approximate that. Because especially like... The physical form of Snake and how the camera is, like, not shy at all about coming in close. The amount of detail in the furnishings throughout that level where he is exploring is just... It is definitely next level. And for Kojima to talk about, oh, well, you know, it's going to be on... Like, there's some weird stuff going on there as far as a translation or something. Because, like, first it sounded like he was saying it was for next gen. And then there was some... going back and saying, oh, by next gen, he meant these consoles that are out, that it'll run on 360 and PS3.
I don't buy that.
I mean, I don't buy that.
I think Fox Engine is clearly Konami's, you know, Frostbite, you know, where it'll it won't look anywhere near that good on
PS3
and 360, but it's clearly ready for next gen.
Considering he was wired into dev station, a computer, a PC-based dev station.
Wasn't that they going to do PC as well? I remember them saying
they actually haven't announced a PC version.
That was during the thing when they were like, Big Boss wants you to work on something for PC on the Fox Engine or something, when it was all rumors and stuff.
So once we get past the pretty layer on the top of it, what do you guys think about this idea that has been hinted at? And certainly, you know, they were fostering this idea of a more open world like Metal Gear, a more, hey, you can go and do what you want to do in these environments, because Metal Gear level design has been a integral part of what made the game work so well. You had a very clear, you know, cinematic pacing and narrative, and part of keeping the player in that moment was the control, very carefully crafted control, like a Disneyland adventure, right? Of like, I know where the player is, why they're there, what they're doing, what their motivation is, and then how I'm crafting the rest of this experience around that. If I throw open the doors and make it more, hey, Adam, go do what you want to do, you're playing Snake, that introduces a lot of variables. What do you guys think of that?
It's a great idea in the abstract. The practical application, especially where Kojima's strengths have been, that's almost like that's a large can of worms you just opened. And, you know, I'm trying to think, what's a Metal Gear game without the focus? That's just a very strange concept.
But Metal Gear Solid 4 did offer, you know, at least those two different styles of gameplay where you could approach it as a shooter, you can approach it as a completely stealth-based game. And, you know, it's sort of interesting when I was playing MGS4 and then I would let a friend play, and I would watch after the half-hour installation wait, going to an earlier chapter, and he would just play completely differently. So, like, I think the mechanics are actually pretty open already, and for me, what is frustrating is when the game ends because I made one stupid mistake, you know, and I just can't figure out a way to get out of that. You know, I get in that alert cycle where, you know... Like, oh, God, the exclamation point came out, the alert went down to yellow, but someone else spotted you now, and just... I would love to see a game that had the mechanics of MGS4, but offered a slightly more.
So you're thinking
long
of his
experience. Yeah.
You're thinking of his expressed goal then to have no game over in this game.
Yeah, I mean,
that's
think
a very
really
interesting comment.
Yeah. And it's that's perfect. I think that's it, because I think where I've always been frustrated with Metal Gear Solid games is there's always I always feel like I'm doing something wrong. And I don't think that game should encourage that on the player. But I also think there's something very endemic to a lot of Japanese games, and in particular Kojima's games, that there really is a right way. Just, you know, with exclamation points, with those sounds, those are all saying negative, negative. You know, you have done something wrong.
That's kind of what I loved about MGS3, and that was kind of the first thing that came to mind when I saw the Ground Zero stuff, is that when you play MGS3 on really high difficulty levels, it becomes something more than I think any other Metal Gear game, which is almost this like mini Minecraft kind of thing where you're really focused on survival. You're really focused on hunting after particular animals because of the buffs that they will give you. And, oh, I can trank this snake and then throw it at a dude and it won't count towards my kill count and that kind of thing. There was more, I think, emergent gameplay in MGS3 than in any of the other Metal Gear Solid games combined. And I'm really the optimist in me, the guy who looks dumb, is really hoping that, you know, Ground Zeroes is going to be that on a massive scale.
Yeah, you know, after having heard the description of it over Twitter, waiting for actual seeing it over the PAX weekend, I was like, I was surprised at how well it lived up to the hype meter that I had already, like, spiked to Super Extreme. It's weird for me because, as those of you who listen to the show know, I've only completely finished Metal Gear Solid 4, and I played a good bit of 1 and a good bit of 3 and hardly touched 2. I don't know why I never hardly touched 2. That was weird.
Raiden's so pretty. Why wouldn't you?
Oh, I know why I hardly touched 2. Is like once a vampire showed up, I'm like, okay, that's it. No. You I mean, at least sit down and explain.
It takes them until like MGS4 to explain it, and then they just go nanomachines. It's like, oh, that made sense. You should have just said that 2 games ago.
And nanomachines.
No, I mean, yeah. MGS4, a lot of the explanations are like, huh. That was easy. Like, yeah. Lolly Lule Lo, that was so easy.
Yeah, I'll take that. I'll buy it.
See, we'll swallow whatever you're feeding us as long as we're, like, liking the rest of it. It's like, oh, sure, I'll take that.
That's the thing that's amazing about Metal Gear Solid to me, is that it's got, like, you know, a lot of people accuse Japanese games narratively of being sort of all over the place and not really having, and, like, Metal Gear Solid is definitely all over the place, but it somehow finds the exact right spots to be grounded and to be believable, that you take everything else sort of in stride, and everything just becomes flavor rather than something that's pulling you out.
It's also consistent. I mean, one of the reasons I didn't play 2 was because there was just too much story intruding. Like, I couldn't get a moment to actually play the damn game after the first level. But it's consistent in its absurdity, and you get the sense that, yes, there is someone driving this bus. And, you know, that's kind of the appeal. It's like, okay, maybe this will eventually all come together, and it will make sense, which I think it finally did. With some very long cutscenes in MGS4.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, you know, they're going to have a much easier time on their hands proving that in the Metal Gear Solid world than you will in the Final Fantasy world, where they're going to bring back a third installment of Final Fantasy 13, again, centered around Lightning, hopefully solving. Now, you know, I think it's interesting how many people went and bought into 13 too, you know, because originally, like, 13 was a long time coming, and then there was like, oh, it's great, but no, it's a corridor, and there's like, you know, sentiment certainly wavered back and forth between do we like it, do we not like it, was it worth a payoff. 13 2 comes along, changes things. If you haven't played 13 2, I will steer clear of spoiling it, but by saying that there are events at the end of 13 that are then negated and changed by where 13-2 goes, because 13-2 then plays a time traveling story, and 13-2 winds up at a climax that really is leading to what really is going to happen.
Blood is shooting out of my nose right now.
Finish the fight.
And it's interesting to see how they've also decided to really rearrange what they're doing with the game. The game's called Lightning Returns Final Fantasy 13. So already they've changed the priority by making Lightning first. You're only going to play as Lightning throughout the entire game. No party. Well, actually, you'll have a party, but you only play as Lightning. Now, of course, if you remember 13, you have an active character and everyone else is playing through the paradigms, remember? And here, you're going to have direct control over Lightning inside the battle screen. So you'll be able to move her around. Like imagine that.
So this sounds more like Mass Effect.
It sounds a lot like Mass
Effect.
Well,
I mean,
Except that you can imagine it's Final Fantasy. You're still probably going to, you know, get into battle, then stop, render up the battle environment, and then you're going to drop into the battle environment.
Do you think so? I actually would question that.
Yeah, I don't see that happening.
I mean, if you look at the progression, I mean, 13, as you said, a long time coming, and it was mired in some pretty archaic, even with the changes that they had in the combat system. I mean, yeah. It was the last time I ever allowed a review to go out that said it gets good after the first 50 hours, which is just one of the most horrible things you could ever say about. But then 2 really seems to address it, and it comes out faster.
Yes.
Now we're about to have 3, and it sounds like there's some dramatic changes. Like, maybe there is some consideration that you've got to change the format of these games to be a little bit more contemporary. Well, and with Eidos also so involved in Square now, I mean, I think there's a chance.
I think there's a reason why they didn't call it 13-3, though.
Oh, definitely.
I think the fact that it's such a huge departure, I think, you know, that's one of the reasons why you're not going to call it Final Fantasy 13-3, just because I think they're... In spite of, you know, people making fun of the fact that this franchise has been around for so long, Square actually does change things up pretty significantly every game in the mainline series. So, you know, from the just basic description of it, I wouldn't be surprised if they just threw everything out.
Also, I think that a modern marketing department might raise their hand when presented with something that says 13-3. Because it doesn't make sense. I mean,
why wouldn't they raise their hand with 13-2, though?
Because that makes perfect sense.
Of course.
I mean, I think things are changing finally at a faster clip. I mean, it is. You're not going to find yourself a larger audience, which the Final Fantasy games, as popular as they have been, are not what they once were, and they're this absolute sort of reliable, like 100 million copy sellers. They've got to be able to invite in a new audience, and by slapping 13-2 on something, well, okay, I haven't played the first 12, and I haven't played the other ones that are 13, and you know, someone's going to go for something that looks safer that doesn't have this sort of legacy that they're supposed to have.
But so, at the same time, I don't think the marketing department has any say at Square Enix, because this is still the company that made Dissidia Duodecim 012 Final Fantasy.
Yeah, yeah. As a guy that had to do VOs of game reviews, I hated that game.
I can't even begin to imagine. Well, I think that from my standpoint, that part of what I'm thinking is that I don't feel like they were going to radically step outside the engine, because one of the economies of doing this sequence of games is recouping all of the R&D money that went into developing 13. So that's why I was thinking, you know, in the battle screen, I think that if they were able to have handled battle in the world map or in the environment map that you're in, that they would have already tried to incorporate that.
It's hard for me to believe that a contemporary engine like the Final Fantasy 13 engine would actually force you to have to do combat in the way
But have a lot going on in the back end. I mean, I don't know exactly how it works, obviously.
And neither do I. So
they seem to have to load a combat environment. And I'm thinking that, and by environment, I mean more than just the visual world you see, but they're also loading the UI. They're loading all of the back end systems to run the characters. Keep in mind, if you played 13, while you were playing your character, all the characters were moving around in the battle environment.
Well, usually Final Fantasy games use different character models for the system and world map. And that's like sort of easily rectifiable by now having a game that only has one character that you control.
One character that you control, I think that the other characters will still be with you.
Well,
it's not going to be a solo adventure.
No, I could see them doing that where the characters just appear as cameos.
Pulling a Dirge of Cerberus kind of thing?
Yeah, okay, that was the game I was thinking of. Dirge's.
And that was so successful for them.
I doubt. I think that what it is it takes...
If you don't name games Dirge of Cerberus, you might, or Cerberus or whatever, Cerberus is a comic book.
You don't want to buy Dirges?
Yeah, I mean, it's just stop picking names out of a hat and calling it the title of a game. I want them to do well. They just keep on stepping on their
army
thingy.
Of demons.
Theater rhythm. It's...
I think it's theatrhythm.
No, actually, I think it's theater rhythm, because I said theatrhythm, and I think the Square Enix person was like, no, excuse me.
It's theater rhythm. It's theater rhythm. It's a theater of movies and rhythm game all in one with your favorite Final Fantasy songs.
At this point, it's sort of amusing, though. It's amusing.
It is.
So anyway, I still haven't made this point about the combat. So What I think is that if you look back at that engine, you already had characters moving around. So it's not that much of a leap to think that, oh, they had enough time working with it to figure out how to give the player control over movement within that combat engine, right? And then the other thing that they said that they're doing is that you'll still have the active time battle gauge. So you'll still have, you know, a time meter that lets you know when you can act. But that instead of using menus to pull out what you're doing, you'll map your actions to the face buttons on the controller, which is exactly what happened in Gestalt mode with your what do they call the summons in this in Eidolons. So yes,
can you hear him facepalming? Can you hear Adam Sessler facepalming?
Anyway,
you know that sort of sounds like the Tails battle system. Now that I think about it, like if you think about. Directly controlling one character while still entering a different battle engine. So, I mean, and the Tails games do well.
Exactly. So I think this could be kind of cool. And they also said it's going to have a happy ending.
Spoilers.
Well, spoilers. It's going to have a happy ending.
I'm going to go to sleep better.
Well, I think that the funny thing is they had to promise that it would have an ending and actually would wrap up the 13 story arc because people after 13.2 were probably the true fan after 13.2 was probably like, oh, no, you screwed me once. I don't know about this. I'm not going to go back in there. But you should play it multiple times, apparently. It's going to have a great happy ending. It will wrap things up, but you should play it multiple times.
Back to the marketing department. You have a game that long and you're telling the player to play it multiple times so they won't buy any other Square Enix titles for the rest of the year. Oh, God, that company drives me crazy.
What other games did you want them to buy this year?
I don't know.
Sleeping Dogs?
Something with sexy nuns. With
sexy
guns.
Sexy nuns with guns.
Yeah.
Have you played any, checked out any of the Hitman?
No. I saw some of it when I was at E3. I was not up at PAX, so I did not have the opportunity.
Yeah, we both saw that demo at E3, and I came away relatively impressed by that game.
Yeah, I mean, I think the trailer was obnoxious. I think the game has quite a bit of potential.
I kind of like the way they're trying to incentivize trying other methods with their sort of score system. Like, I thought it was a really clever way of, like, keeping all the complexity and all the different ways of killing somebody while trying to bring that more to the forefront and make it accessible to a wider audience of people who aren't just doing Let's Plays on YouTube.
You know, they didn't make a huge deal out of it, but did you see that a couple of weeks ago the nun level has been redesigned due to pressure from, you know, popular
nun groups,
I guess. But, you know, due to backlash to the trailer, over the trailer, the nun level has been redesigned.
But it was more that the tone of it seemed completely at odds with how we understand Hitman. The ostensible gameplay it was demonstrating was completely at odds with Hitman. But I do like this idea of the scoring system in Hitman because I'm not usually a huge fan of scoring systems like in shooters. Say like what was the one from last year from
Bulletstorm?
I like the game. I had a lot of fun. But the thing is, when you're having that kind of fast-paced challenge, it's hard to get that balance of how much do I just want to survive versus how much do I want to be like really, really kind of stylish in the way I do it. With the pacing that we're used to from Hitman, I think that it opens up a good pocket for the player to really get a better sense to experiment. Mm-hmm. I think you do have to kind of lower the barrier of punishment on the player if you're going to try to bring up the level of experimentation.
All right, well, there's no reason to beat around the bush any longer. We're going to take a little break. When we come back on the other side, we will get into Borderlands 2, which has a number of questions from you guys for me to throw at Anthony. I'm going to let him warm up here with a little quick one to get you ready. How did you guys decide? This one is from Thrower Guy. It says, how did you decide where to go from the conclusion of the first Borderlands?
Honestly, a lot of it came from player feedback. They had very specific things that they thought were kind of missing, either narratively or otherwise, and we worked really hard to try to tackle that stuff first. Stuff like, there's not really a clear villain in the first game. Like, technically your villain's Commandant Steele, but she has, like, maybe 10 lines in the game. And, you know, there was not quite a payoff at the end like they wanted to. So very like, all right, we'll do a clear villain, and we'll have a really big, awesome payoff at the end, and we'll just write around that idea.
There's a pretty damn big thing at the end of Borderlands that you have to kill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it didn't drop the best loot in the world was the complaint, you know. You were promised awesome loot when you opened the vault and you got a boss monster that was very big and you could, one of the most satisfying things to do as Brick was to just get inside of its eye and punch it until it died.
I didn't know you could do that.
You can.
Oh, really?
I think it's technically a glitch, but it's the best glitch ever, so who cares? But yeah, I think a lot of the promise was loot and then you got calamari and it was kind of a downer to some people.
Who doesn't want calamari?
I do on one level understand where they're coming from, but the other is, have they seen Pulp Fiction?
Right.
How do they feel about the end of that movie?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're never going to see inside the briefcase. I mean, it was, I think just given how much loot was in the game to begin with, mm-hmm. I think I never occurred to me that there was going to be something that much better.
Yeah.
But I you know, maybe it didn't have that same sense of resolution to just sort of wrap the whole thing up. I don't think it had a denouement like you know, I think it was leading up to.
But you know what? The part of it was that this was a world you were playing around in, and there was a tremendous amount of DLC coming.
Yeah.
You know, so Ariel and I played the hell out of Borderlands, but we were just talking about this in the pre-show, that the only DLC we ever played was Ratchet. I mean, not Ratchet. Ratchet. Why did I say, where did Ratchet come from?
Yeah, that's really weird.
Yeah. Well, though, a Ratchet cameo would be amazing.
That would be awesome.
That would be amazing.
I would love to do that.
He comes running in with a wrench, and he looks at Claptrap and goes, why the hell am I here? And runs back out. It was Claptrap's New Robot Revolution. We played that, and that was great, and we enjoyed like that world. But I think that if you'd had a really strong ending, would you have been able to keep going back like that? I mean, part of the reason we were cool with going back or going in and playing more was we didn't feel like we had just like completely closed the door on Pandora.
Well, oh yeah.
Well, think about Fallout though. They had a pretty finite ending to that, and then the DLC sort of changed it. So I don't think players really care.
Well, also Borderlands has that wonderful humor to it, and almost like an elasticity to the world. Like, it's not like there's like, I feel there's a hard rule set that it has to, you know, really, really adhere to. And I think that really opens up all these wonderful opportunities, because Zombie Island of Dr. Ned or Zed or Ned.
Ned. Yeah.
Ned, you know, really is such a tonal shift.
Oh, yeah.
And it completely works within the game. Mm-hmm. I think because the game has that sense of fun.
It was slightly baffling to us at the end of New Robot Revolution, because like the end phase of that game is you battling all the bosses from the prior.
Oh yeah, you haven't met any of them before.
Like, oh, this guy's weird. Oh look, there's General Knox. General Knox is pretty badass. Oh well, I guess we'll just have to kill him.
Yeah,
it was really, it's really this quite strange progression if you haven't done the other DLC packs.
Yeah, you should totally check out the others. They're really good.
New game comes out in a week.
Yeah, it's too late.
Yeah, it's too late. I mean,
we actually bring back a lot of characters from particular. I mean, like Moxie's back, and you know, it's nice to meet her. But nah, whatever. You just play the new game.
Yeah, I'm just gonna come on. I'm gonna play the new game. I have to get ready to play my assassin, because I get the assassin done in time to be able to play the Necromancer.
Well,
when
do you have a PlayStation Plus?
I don't have PlayStation Plus.
If you did, you could get it for free.
Yeah, you just download the game, and then all the DLC is $10.
Well,
all of it. All of it's $10.
The DLC's not that expensive anyway. I have Borderlands and Robot. I mean, I think they're like, what, $10 a pack or something. But yeah, anyway, I'm going to play the new game, which when we come back on the other side, we will let Anthony set up the new game, and we have a bunch of your questions. We will talk Borderlands 2 when Weekend Confirmed continues. This week's episode of Weekend Confirmed is brought to you by Random House Audio. Here's a sample from Star Wars Darth Plagueis by James Lucerne, read by Daniel Davis.
The Force so strong within him that he feared he might disappear into it, never to return. But the moment didn't constitute an ending so much as a true beginning, long overdue. It was less a transformation than an intensification, a gravitic shift. A welter of voices, near and far, present and from eons past, drowned his thoughts. Raised in praise, the voices proclaimed his reign and cheered the inauguration of a new order. Yellow eyes lifted to the night sky, he saw the trembling stars flare, and in the depth of his being, he felt the power of the dark side anoint him.
Visit www.randomhouseaudio.com and play something new. All right, and we are ready to get into Borderlands 2. Thank you, Anthony, who I'll let take it away. I thought what we'd do is let him sort of give an overview of Borderlands 2, a little, like, ease us into it, set the stage with the characters, the story, where we're going, and then we'll get right back to you guys' questions with a little bit of framework in place.
Sure. Borderlands 2 narratively takes place 5 years after the first Borderlands, and this new bad guy, Handsome Jack, has sort of come to Pandora and taken it over, because when the vault opened, some new alien element called Iridium came out, and he got a bunch of it and got rich. And now sort of Pandora is sort of this fascist wasteland where it used to be a post-apocalyptic wasteland. Now it's a fascist wasteland, and your whole job basically is to get the band back together, get the four vault hunters from the first game, meet them, and sort of join forces to take down Handsome Jack and not bring peace to Pandora, but bring slightly less death to Pandora, I guess.
So that's one of the questions, actually, that a listener had. Chuck Jose asked, how much influence will the original characters of Roland, Lilith, Brick, and Mordecai have on the main story?
A great deal. A lot of the plot involves sort of tracking them down, seeing what they're up to, and there are a couple of missions where they will fight alongside you in various ways and actually sort of be companions, and it's actually pretty cool. But yeah, the idea early on was like, we want new character classes, but you know, when you've played for 30, 40 hours as Mordecai, you kind of would be sad if you didn't see him again. So, yeah, we basically just put them all in the story. And the fun thing there was like, okay, what are Lilith and Roland and Mordecai and Brick like when they're not just shouting like, boom, headshot, you know, every 5 minutes, and sort of being able to write the way that they can interact with each other and sort of being able to actually sort of look at them as real characters rather than sort of ciphers that say fun things when you get a headshot. It was a neat challenge.
You know, in loot-based games, I think that it's always an interesting point to look at how the story is balanced with the action, because it's very easy to get caught up just in the action of the game. Mm-hmm. There's a lot. Look, Pandora grew to be a very, very big and rich place. I'm wondering how much of that was sort of the whole, like, building the plane as its landing part, or how much of it was, we have this giant book of, here's what Pandora is. Because, you know, we talk about Handsome Jack, there's also the hints every so often about, like, what's going on in the even broader universe than just Pandora. Like, Pandora is this planet, but, you know, there's people sent there to be bounty hunters, and then there are all these other, like, interplanetary agencies that might be at work, and those struggles. How much of that is fleshed out, and what does the bigger picture of what's going on around Pandora look like?
There are certain details that are really fleshed out, at least in my head. There are some that we're totally just making up as we go along. But the really high level stuff, the really big epic, oh, save this for the sequel kind of stuff is all, you know, fleshed out, and it's locked away somewhere in my head and probably in Randy. So as long as we don't fly on the same plane together, it'll probably be fine.
Have you guys considered what the universe is this planet inhabits? Like, mm-hmm. if you went to a more populated and urbanized planet, what that would actually be like?
Yeah, I think there's actually the Borderlands comics are coming out now. They're called, like, Origins or something like that. Mikey Newman, who wrote the first game, wrote them. And I'm pretty sure that I'm certain that you visit other planets that aren't Pandora. And all of them are kind of shitty places to be, but nowhere is as bad as Pandora. We sort of wanted to make it feel like, you know, this is the very edge of the universe. This is the border.
So this universe kind of is out of a heavy metal magazine. Where,
oh, yeah,
like,
totally.
Everything is just kind of malevolent and dangerous.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, filled with death.
We had that sort of philosophy when we were dealing with the weapons manufacturers, because one of the big high-level goals was, like, let's make the weapon manufacturers feel like they have more personality. So every gun feels different, all that kind of stuff. But then when it came down to writing, like, well, I was going to write, like, advertisements for them, and we released some videos and did some, like, you know, advertisements in the game. And it was sort of, we were sort of realizing, okay, are any of these guys, any of these corporations good? And then we're like, no, they're actually all completely willing to sell you out and let you die. But the only difference is, like, who's going to do it first? You know? And we sort of rank them according to how evil and whatever the name of the evil corporation is in RoboCop, you know? Omnicore or whatever the hell.
Yeah, Omnicore.
Yeah. Who is most like Omnicore? And then we just made a list going down.
Look, if you're not exploiting your customer, you're obviously not trying, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
clearly, that is the core message here. Darth Burrito and Reverend Anthony ask a question that's right up your alley. They ask if you could describe sort of the writing process for a game like Borderlands 2 and how you divide up the work and what it looks like, you know, that balance between narrative and then I'm adding this part, what it looks like the balance between narrative and scripting for all of the missions and keeping a story going across all of that.
Well, it's actually a bunch of different stages. That's kind of the fun of it, is it's like I have like three different jobs that happen sort of sequentially. First is like, okay, what's the overarching story? And myself and Paul Hellquist, who's the creative director, sort of locked ourselves in a room for 3 weeks and came up with all the high-level story beats and stuff like that. And then it came down to working with level designers and the mission designers and all that stuff and finding like, what kind of stuff do you want to do? How can I change my story idea to fit this level that you want to do? And do you have any cool level ideas that you want me to put into the story and, you know, all that kind of stuff? That's one of the great things about being a full-time on-staff writer was that I wasn't just in some remote location who called in every, you know, 5 hours and was like, bye. And then just, you know, didn't actually deal with anybody on the team. I was constantly going between the art team and the level design team and the mission designers and saying, different ideas that we could sort of hash out together. Like, there's a level designer, Ben Gettleman, who was like, or a mission designer who was like, I really want to do a quest that's just all about Top Gun references. Could you write something like that? I was like, could I? And just sort of did it. And then vice versa, I would have this stupid idea for, like, you know, what if we had this quest that was just, you know, the exact opposite of what you want out of a quest? It doesn't have any good gameplay and it kind of sucks, and that's the joke. And then and then we tried to, you know, make that work. And it was actually really, really collaborative in that way.
I mean, I would assume that there must be some benefit to the fact that, you know, Borderlands 1 went through so many changes, its art style, I think also its tone and everything like that, that, mm-hmm. you know, with starting Borderlands 2, that's already kind of set. You already kind of have that kind of clarity. I mean, that must be quite liberating for you.
It was, but it wasn't without its hard parts because, you know, Borderlands 1 sort of set in motion the idea that, like, okay, Borderlands doesn't actually always have to be serious. It can be funny and stuff like that. But there was still sort of decisions that had to be made about, like, okay, is the Zombie Island of Dr. Dead even canon? Like, is that just some crazy story Marcus tells? Would we be allowed to put zombies into Borderlands 2 and have that make sense? Or would people be like, this is too silly, this is dumb? And, you know, there's a spectrum. At one end is, you know, is Saints Row 3, and at the other end is, like, Heavy Rain. And sort of, we're somewhere in the middle there, but exactly how far can we go? Can we go to Dildo Bat far? Probably not. Can we go to, like, I Lost My Son, like, sad? Probably not. And it was sort of trying to find the idea that anytime we do anything really goofy, like this character Tiny Tina, making sure that she's grounded in something really kind of dark, like her backstory. And that was sort of the sweet spot for finding what Borderlands' sort of tone was.
So who is Tiny Tina?
Tiny Tina is a, like, 13-year-old bomb maker character that helps you about third of the way through the game. And she's just she was really fun for me to write. I think she's going to be really divisive because she's just completely hyperactive and insane and, like, says things off the chizzo for Rizzo, but, like, in a little girl's voice, and, like, has a tea party where she wants to invite this guest of honor named Fleshstick. But the reason she wants to invite him is because he killed her parents, and the tea party is an extended torture sequence where you defend the guy against waves of bandits. Like, yeah. And yeah, and she's, like, voiced by my sister because nepotism is awesome and all that stuff. But yeah.
That sounds awesome.
I don't even know how to follow that up. I'm completely swept off my game by that.
I mean, I'm kind of, I am actually putting your writing at this level, but it's making me think of Joseph Conrad's The Secret Agent, like the professor. One of the greatest characters in all of English literature is the professor who's the bomb maker who's helping out these anarchists, but he's this crazy guy who walks around, you know, 19th century London with a bomb strapped to him that he can set off at any moment, just talking things to the cops because he knows no one will touch him. And yeah, so I would guess that Tiny Tina and him seem to be the same.
Yeah,
I've
often been compared to Joseph Conrad.
Yes, I thought.
Yeah, all the time.
It happens all the time. It's not uncommon.
Yeah.
I think that it's good for me to hear the sort of off the wall ideas like this, because one of the common complaints about any sort of character building, loot mechanic based game comes from how quickly the quests can get repetitious, right? Mm-hmm. It becomes, oh, go step and fetch this. How did you guys address that, both from a writing standpoint and from a scenario design standpoint?
From a scenario design standpoint, we overhauled the mission system completely. Like, if you go back and play the first Borderlands or any of its DLCs, there was no ability for objectives to change mid-mission. If somebody said, go collect 50 skag cans,
you just had to go get them,
You just got them, and then it was done, and you turned it in, and there was no surprise there. What was really a useful narrative tool, and just in gameplay in general, was every mission in the game just has a changing objectives. You think you're doing this one thing, and then some monkey wrench comes in your way, and, you know, the way that good fiction is supposed to work, where just obstacles sort of happen. Narratively, a lot of it was just me sort of sitting down, and, like, I used to be, I hesitate to say journalist, but I wrote for Destructoid for the blog for a while before I ever did Hey Ash, my web series, which got me the job at Gearbox. So I've played, you know, and talked about games for forever. So a lot of the means of trying to make the missions feel different was sitting down to think about every single video game cliche I didn't like, or every single, you know, mission I'd played 100 times before, and, you know, okay, what's the opposite of that? How can I play around with those cliches? And the great thing about the Borderlands universe being what it is you can do crazy things like the tea party with the guy who's getting tortured to death, and it still sort of works.
What do you think? It's an interesting point, and this was actually something that came up in the comments over the last couple of shows, is what do you think the teetering point is for people's acceptance of, you know, the absurdity of video game stories, and at what point do they lose buy-in and get totally turned off? This came up because last week we talked about the Assassin's Creed 3 creative director saying that, you know, that there was this this subtle racism going on that Western journalists gave Japanese and Eastern designers a little bit of a pass and let them get away with crazy stuff like lollipop chainsaw, like stuff like that. But we won't let Western designers get away with Gears of War 3. And I
kind of see. I mean, I'm obviously I come from the viewpoint of just really just wanting to just kind of just shake the Japanese game industry into just sort of, you know, the 21st century.
Yeah.
I remember the comment. I had to spin around the room a few times.
As people pointed out in the thread, there are plenty of games that of anybody's design, Japanese, North American, or European, that have been flayed lately for just being completely, you know, missing that mark. So how do you find, obviously, Borderlands has to hit that mark because the art style, the whole premise of it, the whole way it comes together is all about being that that, like you said, finding that beat that's comedic and fun, but at the same time can be a little more serious. How do you navigate that?
I think this kind of goes back to what we were talking about with Metal Gear Solid. Like, I think you can go as silly or as weird or as crazy as you want to, as long as you have something that anchors you, as long as the player or the audience or whatever you want to call them has something that they can relate to and understand. You know, Solid Snake being this grim, sort of sad, you know, like pathetic character in Metal Gear Solid 4, I think really grounded you to the point where, okay, you know, I can buy crazy octopus supermodel lady who will pose and dance for me if I pull out a camera and music will start playing. You know, like, you can have all that insanity if you've got one or two things that make you really understand that this world is something that you can take seriously. I think the games that kind of fail on that count just are just like balls to the wall nonsense and just whatever we can throw.
I think you're right. It's the world. I mean, I really found Pandora itself to be one of the strongest characters in video games of the past few years because you don't know everything about it. It stays mysterious, but I do believe there is more to know about it, like you seem to know that, and it just gives the sense of weight. As a contrast, say a game like Lollipop Chainsaw, that's, I don't know, is it a world? It really feels like a backdrop. And so you really, and I think when that happens, it highlights gameplay. You know, then everything has to be on gameplay, whereas in something like Borderlands, even if you could be doing the same thing over and over again, you know, it is a shooter, it's somehow feels a little bit more dynamic because there's this kind of organic coherence to everything you're doing because it has that foundational world.
Oh yeah, I think you know the ultimate version of that is BioShock. You know, you play through that and it's like, oh my god, I believe literally every detail you're throwing at me, and I will do anything you tell me to do.
Yeah.
All right, we want you to go out to the middle of the ocean and search at this coordinate for the elevator. It's there.
Yes, sir.
Diving bell will come for you. How well are we winning you over, Andrew?
Oh, well.
Have we won you over it? So, by the way, Andrew,
is he not interested?
Not a huge Borderlands fan. Not a loot guy.
Oh.
Yeah.
Now, is it loot that's the issue, or is it just loot kind of indicates a certain type of game you don't like?
I just think I'm just not that interested in mechanics where the reward is a bigger number. You know?
You're more of an ascetic when it comes to...
Well, I think what's kind of neat about... Like, I see what you're coming from. I think what's kind of neat about Borderlands, or at least Borderlands 2 specifically, because I've I was saying this before the show, I've played it through about, like, 7, 8, 9 times, like, something stupid like that. I'll go home and play it just because I'm a dork. But I think what's really interesting about it is that the skill points that you get as you sort of level up your character, we have a lot more skills that we call game changers that basically will completely change the way that you use a particular action skill. So, like, Axton has this skill called... he basically just throws out a saber turn and it does a bunch of damage. You can put a skill on that basically makes a bubble shield around it. So where you used to throw the thing out and just sort of leave it be, now you want to stick really close to it because it'll block all incoming bullets and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, Maya's the same way. She has one that's, she has a phase lock that does a lot of damage. Oh, okay, that's cool. She has one that actually takes over enemies' minds and makes them fight on your side. And then if that guy dies, then the phase lock goes to another person. So you can actually hypnotize in sequence every single person in a group until they're all dead. And it's like super satisfying. That, I think, you know, if you're at all into to narrative stuff, we sort of rejiggered the entire, like, the script's like 7 times bigger than the first game script. And
narrative stuff, that's the best-selling term I have ever heard.
Yeah. I'm a writer, I get paid to say words.
Narrative stuff.
That was 700% more words.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a big multiplier.
Yeah, no, it's a big, big multiplier, and a lot of that was for the single-player gamer who's like, I don't really care about co-op, I don't necessarily care, loot's nice, but I kind of play these games to, you know, feel like I'm part of a world, stuff like that. So if you want to sort of play it like a BioShock, like a linear shooter where you just care about the story, you can just do story missions and sort of go through and have it be your single player narrative driven experience if you like, or have your fun co-op and totally ignore all the stuff I wrote, and that's completely fine. I'm honestly fine with that. Like, the gameplay comes first, first and foremost. So.
But the writing is there in the co-op. It's not like it's...
Yeah, no, okay. We don't like delete half or anything. Okay. It's just, you know, we knew that just by the nature of co-op, while my dialogue's going on, you're going to be like, oh, I found this thing, and talking to your friends and laughing about stuff that happened. And that's much more important than, like, this joke Anthony thought was funny 2 years ago.
And just so everyone knows, you're crying right now when you say that and you disparage
No, honestly, honestly.
Honestly, as he's, like, scratching himself.
I think some of the strongest game stories come from people who respect the gameplay is more important. You play Portal and you listen to Eric Wolpaw talk about the place of narrative in gaming, and he talks about it as if it's musical accompaniment in a film. It shouldn't be anything that's overpowering. It shouldn't be anything that necessarily draws away from what really matters. It's there to enhance this experience, not to take away from it, not to harm it.
And that brings us back to Metal Gear Solid 2.
I think you already kind of answered Nicholas Vaughn's question, which was a comparison between the first game story and this game story. But one piece that he brought out was, if the first story didn't hold our attention throughout the entire campaign, how did you work to change that? Basically, how does it compare to the first? But how does it compare from keeping you going, and what's the pacing and beats like?
Oh, that's actually a very good way to phrase it, is pacing and beats. Because the first Borderlands had a lot of story, but a lot of it was buried in mission text, and a lot of it was very scant. And what we did in Borderlands 2 was making sure that all that stuff is now just said. You know, something as simple and small as that actually changes the entire dynamic. Because every time you complete an objective, every time you enter a new area, every time you do anything that's progressing the plot, you get an update from somebody, and you get told, oh, okay, this is why this is important. This is, you know, a fun little tidbit about this area, or, you know, some fun joke or something like that, to make you feel like you're constantly part of this adventure and you're on a quest rather than sort of checking off a bunch of things from a shopping list. And combining that with all the crazy things that we did. I keep hitting things and making the audio sound awful. I'm sorry. Combining that with all the crazy changes we made to the mission system, like, you know, branching missions and multiple turn-ins and time missions, available missions, and all that kind of stuff, I think we'll probably do a much better job of making you feel immersed in what's going on and making you feel, you know, invested.
Where to go next on this? You guys sent me a lot of stuff. Let's see here. We've answered many of your questions by virtue of talking through the game. Here's one that's quite good. One of them asks, granted, you've talked about some of your influences, but what do you think are, thematically, what are some of the influences on Borderlands, especially Borderlands 2?
We have this thing where we call them keywords, and we have like five words that anytime you want to make a decision, you go to the keywords, and how many of the keywords does it hit? And if it hits all five, then do it. And it's like choice, discovery, growth, something else, and or badass, and the last one's Verhoeven, because the thought was always that movies like RoboCop or Starship Troopers can get away with so much insane shit. Like, what other movie during a chase scene just has the guy suddenly hit a radioactive vat of acid and then turn into a mutant that then immediately gets hit by a car and explodes for no reason, because they still have some grounding in like really dark, awful stuff happening? That being able to sort of see where the Verhoeven tone lies and his like weird sort of social commentary that's buried under an avalanche of bullets and blood was sort of a thing to hit for us.
So you've played through the game 7 times.
Something like that.
Which is kind of awesome.
It is 9. I was wrong.
2 more times. Whatever.
Yeah.
It's no big deal.
It's just like 80 hours of my life that I'll never get back because it's so awesome and I don't want them back.
And someone right now is going, let's see, so we played it through 9 times in 70 hours. That means it's an 8-hour game.
No, we had the Brady Games guys when they were doing the strategy guide. We were like, do all the side quests and all the main plot and tell us how long it is. And they said something like 60 hours.
60
yeah.
hours.
Adam's telling me, yeah, that's close enough.
Right around
60
hours.
He's waving 5.
Yeah, 5 hours. Around 60 hours. And that's just first place.
He's not the fringe guy with 6 fingers on his head. What I was going to ask, though, is that now you've done all that, and without spoiling, you know, big story reveals, obviously a lot of crazy things must have happened. Tell me, like, a couple of your favorite stories with your favorite characters that have happened in the game.
Oh, man.
You got to set up the character first, because now everyone's going to know, because it's 4 new characters now.
Right. Oh, you mean you just about the new player characters?
Let's set up, like, something you did with them that, like, really showed off some of the cool, like, something that, like, we've all... Adam and I played the game. I love the assassin. I love the assassin because I can be, like, you know, sitting there with my rifle and taking pot shots, but then, you know, I can get right in the thick of it with the katana.
Right.
And the ability to slice and dice through people is, like, really cool. And I'm sure that what's going on, I mean, and I didn't see this happen yet, but what happened a lot of times, you know, in playing co-op with Ariel was like, we would be playing and we would have like awesome setups because she played Lilith and I would always be at the back. And like I would be guarding her, and so she'd be like way off in the front, and we'd just have like crazy times of like, oh, I need you to hit that guy right to the left, and I take him out, and like he would melt in acid. And anyway, like that sort of play back and forth. What kind of cool setups have you seen?
Oh man, I played through the game as Zero while Randy Varnell, our design producer, played as Maya. And he was playing as a sniping Maya because her phase lock, she can phase lock anybody from across the map. It doesn't matter how long the distance.
So Maya's the new Siren?
Yeah, sorry. Maya's the new Siren. And okay. her action skill is phase lock, where she just sort of traps an enemy in a bubble of magic energy stuff and basically just makes them more susceptible to damage, or it has all these crazy buffs and stuff like that. Zero the Assassin, his action skill is deception, where he throws out a clone and can basically just do a massive amount of damage to a single target with a shot. We came up with this rhythm where he would stand back and snipe. He was a healing Siren because she has all these cool healing skills. He would phase lock something. I would get really low in health because I play like a lunatic, and he would kill something and give me a bunch of health. But then he would phase lock something. While it's phase locked, I put a bunch of points in this skill called ambush, which increases all damage done to an enemy if you're hitting them in the back. It's basically a backstab but for guns, and I got the highest damage shotgun I could find. You had to reload it after every shot, but it had ridiculous damage.
It's one of those crazy ones.
Yeah, it was a Jacobs breech loaded shotgun. And I would just basically jump up while they were phase locked and just hit him in the back, and they would just melt. Like, we came up with this awesome rhythm, and we called it the Shotgun Ninja Sniper Maya build or something like that. And Shotgun Ninja is probably my favorite two words I've ever put together.
Awesome. Shotgun Ninja is pretty good.
Yeah. You know, that also just brought back all these memories of playing Borderlands, and I would fall in love with this one gun. And that, like, you know, eventually you knew
eventually
you had to
upgrade. Eventually it gets
outclassed. And it gets outclassed. But saying goodbye.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, when I had this one shotgun that had a scope, and, like, the headshots just kept coming. And it was just, I could do that all day long. And then, I had to put away my old gun and move on to something new. It was very painful.
Yeah. Well, we added a bank actually for that exact emotion, for, like, I'll see you maybe on another character. I'll put it in my bank and come back for you later.
It's like when you finally realize the numbers coming off the enemies with your favorite assault rifle have like dwindled to
the
extent.
Yeah.
Like, but I love her.
I'll do it. It's my dog.
And she,
yeah.
Oh, that's so bad.
That's probably the only way that Old Yeller and Borderlands will ever have anything in common.
Actually, I have funny stories that I'll tell you later.
Oh, goodness. So, you know, for experienced hands at Borderlands, what do you think are going to be the big things that jump out over the first few hours as being different?
I think... this is going to sound like marketing nonsense, but honestly, everything. Like
everything? It's all more badass.
We start you in an environment that is very intentionally as visually different from the first game's environment as possible. It's still a wasteland, but it's all snow, and you're fighting completely different enemies. Like there was a lot of talk of like, oh, should we start you off with Skags again? Because Skags are familiar in Borderlands, and is that nice feeling of like getting back into your old coat and, you know, feeling all the little creases in it and stuff. But we very intentionally thought, no, we'll actually start you with a bunch of new stuff. So Bully Mong's big four-armed ape things, and you see all their crazy AI that they have where they can toss parts of the environment at you, and the guns are all completely different. We start you off with some pretty, you know, just this basic pistol, and then we move into all these things of like, oh my god, a gun where every shot explodes, a gun where when you reload it, it explodes like a grenade, and breech-loaded shotguns, and Jacob's guns where you have to fan the hammer.
The exploding reloading gun looks really hard to manage. You have to throw it when you reload it?
When you reload it, it automatically gets thrown like a grenade.
So you get one shot with it?
No, you get as many shots as you want. They're actually my favorite guns in the game because of this strategic element, which is the more bullets are left in your clip when you decide to hit reload, the more damage the explosion will do if it hits. So basically, if you have if you shoot once and then reload and your clip has like 9 bullets in it, you're doing 9 bullets plus an explosion worth of damage to whatever you hit. If you miss...
But you still have the gun.
Yeah, because it digistructs back into your hand. It's this like magical sci-fi technology.
When you're doing the throw, is this something you have some control over the aim? Okay.
Yeah, you get to aim it. But what's really cool is if you miss, you lose that entire clip's worth of ammo. So it's this very high risk, high reward thing.
Yeah, I see what you're doing. Yeah. Okay. And then it's like magically like omni-tooled.
Yeah, basically. We call it Digistruct, but yeah. And what's really, really great about just the flavor of throwing a gun like a grenade is that I've had moments where we have the thing called Fight for Your Life mode. When you go down, you have to kill somebody to get back up and get your second wind. I've had moments where there's one guy left in the arena, and all I've got left are TDRs, and their damage is so great, and the guy's health is so big that I just have to rely on those. So he's running across a football field's distance while I'm just throwing grenades at him, like throwing guns. I'm going, come back, you motherfucker! Like, I'm going, argh! And then, you know, finally you arc the perfect one, and it lands on his head and blows him up, and you get back up, and it's just like the most satisfying thing in the world.
Well, that right there is Borderlands.
That's just embodied
Borderlands.
Yep.
All right, Anthony, I have a closing question for you from Wesley Doe. He says, Reverend Birch, Are there any Easter eggs to look for in reference to your previous work experiences? Or if I see someone hug a dolphin in the game, will I just have to read too much into that moment?
Yeah, there are for both of the people who followed my career before Borderlands. Hi, Mom and Dad. There is a, I used to host a podcast for Destructoid called Podtoy. It was the official Destructoid.com podcast. And I would open every podcast with the phrase, welcome, welcome, faithful listener. And I wrote a character in Borderlands 2 who is a douchey, arrogant, horrible podcast host nerd guy who you get to hear part of his podcast and they all start with welcome, welcome, faithful listener. So it's basically just me pooping on myself and talking about what an arrogant douchebag I think I am.
that is
just
to be
awesome. Fact that there's a, that I have to accept the fact that there are podcasts in the Borderlands universe is brain melting.
Yeah,
I know.
I think they call them Echo Cast just to like make our own word, but yeah, they're totally podcasts.
Well, big thanks to Anthony Birch for coming in on Weekend Confirmed. If you want to follow him on Twitter, you can catch up with him at Reverend Anthony. For everything about, of course, 2K Games and Gearbox Software, you can follow them on Twitter at Gearbox Software at 2K Games. And then Borderlands 2 out next week. And look, if you
September
think you
18th.
Like it, it's like that's
isn't it week after next. Week after next.
Is that week after next?
Yeah,
I think so.
All right,
you're supposed to confirm the weekend, and you don't.
I don't know, dude. I only confirm weekends. The rest of the time, I'm just like, you know, out to lunch or something. I was gonna say something worse. I don't know. Anyway, if you haven't already, if you think you're interested in the game, you clearly should pre-order it, and you know, because you're gonna get Mechromancer
for free,
and
yep.
that's a
$10 value.
And well, she's really well. She's
you get
awesome.
A free character. I mean, you know what? Actually, getting a character. I mean, we've talked about we can actually when we come back after Anthony's left, we can talk about pre-ordered incentives because that's always an interesting conversation. But like getting a free character that would otherwise have to pay for, that's actually something. I mean, I'd way rather have that than some of the other trinkety.
A stuff. Silent shotgun.
Yes.
Yeah.
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 All right, he's got to go catch a plane back to rest of the middle of the world.
Yeah.
You go back to Texas?
Picturesque Plano, Texas.
Well, fly safely, sir. Thanks very much. And thanks to 2K and Gearbox for letting you come out here and come on the show. We still have half a show to go, and if you stick around, we will be right back with that. Watching the sunset over like a palm tree and sipping a drink while I'm listening to that or something. It's very, very mellow. Anyway, thank you again to Gearbox Software, 2K Games, and at Reverend Anthony on Twitter. You can follow him. Hope they are seen off well to LAX and back to Dallas-Fort Worth region. In his stead, we brought in Mr. Ryan Calvano, who you may recognize from the daily show that we put on the YouTubes.
Shaq News Daily.
And he's also the guy behind the camera all the time. He plays games. He does some things.
I do. I'm a gamer.
Continuing the tradition of great videographers who also can get in front of the mic and talk a little trash.
Oh, again, it's an honor to be on the show for my second time.
All right, so Anthony's gone. Obviously, I'm a huge Borderlands fan in the first place, so I apologize if that came off. We were actually talking about, like, Anthony stood up and he was like, "Man, I'm sorry, that sounded like I was a car salesman." And I was like, "I don't know, it didn't." Like, I'm already super hot for Borderlands in the first place. If you're out there thinking, "Oh, that was really shill," like, you know, I'm sorry. I think it was what I wanted to talk about with him is like the story stuff and the things that were interesting.
Well, it's not a game that I'm sitting around with a host of skepticism. I understand, you know, you don't like that type of game, and which you're perfectly entitled to. But yeah, the first Borderlands hit such a sweet spot for me. I think also just I love the gameplay. It was just such a fresh setting and a fresh look and the animation and the colors. It was just like, ah, this is something different. It just, I loved it.
Did you play it solo at all?
Yeah, I played quite a bit. I am still more of a solo player.
Me too. Hmm.
See, I started playing Borderlands solo and it didn't click for me that well. And then when Ariel and I started playing it, it was like immediate. Like, of course,
and people had talked co-op.
Yeah, people had talked about how good the co-op was, and it was easy for me to be skeptical about that, not having done it, and just be like, "Oh, you guys are just talking or whatever." But then you get into it, and you know, you burn hours in that. You burn hours very, very, very quickly.
See, and the whole reason I don't play that much co-op, and especially in a game like Borderlands, I don't always have that many consecutive hours to burn.
Yeah.
You know, between my bladder, my need for food, and having to just kind of attend to the, you know, the annoying aspects of life, I'm always like, I don't know if I can say I could do a 3-hour co-op session all of a sudden.
And finding another person.
Yeah, I have, and that where our schedules link up, because I can't play with strangers because it's how I was brought up. it's just not going to happen.
I'll play death matches, but co-op, no.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll shoot other people, but other than that.
But you know, it's funny because I was thinking about how much we enjoyed playing that game together, and then describing that scenario I was describing to Anthony about her playing the siren and running ahead and me sniping from behind and like, you know, the back and forth, the tactical maneuvering in the levels. There are a lot of games that do multiplayer co-op and very few of them manage to actually pull that off. Very few of them managed to, you know what pulled that off? Syndicate pulled that off.
Really?
Syndicate's co-op was really, really solid. Yeah. Syndicate's co-op had that same sort of, you felt like you were doing your thing and at the same time working with your partner. But that's what worries me about Army of Two, Three, or whatever they're going to talk about.
Lightning Returns, Army of Two.
Yes. Lightning Returns, Army of Two. Because Army of Two is always so forced, right? It's like there's this weird point that you have to reach of making co-op work. And at the same time, not forcing a player to do it. Because as soon as I show my hand and I'm forcing you, you're like, oh, well, now I'm just running up to the wall and pressing A to put my hands down to vault the guy over the wall.
Yeah, but, you know, I guess since EA, you know, won't ever have a single player experience ever come out under their label anymore, then, you know, we shouldn't have to worry about that.
Jeez.
All right, so what Adam is alluding to is EA president.
Huh? Did I throw that one to you pretty well?
You did. You ruined it. You're like Kanata. You gotta throw it away after you get there. Frank Abo, who is president of EA Labels, while speaking at the Cloud, or actually, this was not speaking at, this was written by John Godos. He wrote the Cloud Gaming Prospects for 2012 for Video Game Intelligence. This is in advance of their Cloud Gaming USA conference. Did a little Q&A with Frank, and this is the part that came up. It says, "We're very proud of the way EA evolved with consumers." This is evolution, evidently. It's the way we evolved with consumers. "I have not greenlit one game to be developed as a single-player experience. Today, all of our games include online applications and digital services that make them live 24/7, 365.
Yep. That, I mean, you know, it's just why these comments come out of EA with a fair amount of regularity. And like, and it used to be kind of like Bobby Kotick's thing to just say these things. Look, obviously there's a financial reason for having that multiplayer, but why make such a statement that you're proud that you're not doing anything that's straight single player? Why say it out loud?
He did have a clarification afterwards where he said that, you know, he didn't mean that there wouldn't be any single player games that, you know, it's a direct contradiction to what he said. Yes,
yeah,
I understand that. He's like a politician, really. You know, but the way he was trying to talk about it is actually single player is what makes games great, and you know, a good game.
Now
is
you
better
you,
with single,
you totally
player.
Just spun that like a politician. You went from "we are not doing single player games" to "single player is what makes games
and
really great."
And his clarification was that, you know, every game has an online component, so it could still be single player. It just needs to have some kind of online aspect.
And it's true. We're seeing that happen. But, you know, as a result, we have a dead space that does not seem to be promising to be scary in any way. And
you really don't think any way?
You're
kind of turned. You're the most turned off I've heard, I think, maybe.
I like Dead Space. I really like the franchise, but
it's just different now. Resident Evil?
But it's different. And becoming very familiar to a lot of other games out there. I mean, we're just talking about Army of Two. I mean, I'm not seeing. Yes, of course, the creatures and the things you're shooting at are that different, but I'm not seeing two distinct franchises anymore. I'm seeing EA Horror and EA Big Men. You know, it's just that label, that brand is just losing a distinct quality. I mean, it's always been kind of monolithic, but it just seems more so now, with especially now that Mass Effect is, for all intents and purposes, wrapped up, which was really kind of their shining beacon of investing in something that had a high level of creativity.
Yeah, but investing in that franchise also turned into a third-person shooter. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, after playing the first Mass Effect, they needed to retool it. You know, what happened with Dragon Age 2 is a whole other story. that was not exactly the way you're supposed to go.
I don't think that – I mean, it's nice that he's going to go back and spin it. Obviously, the way he wrote this here at the end of today, all of our games include online application and digital services. I mean, I get it, but that was really what he was speaking to in the first place. I also think, though, that there is definitely still a strong current within big-time publishers that you've got to have that multiplayer component. We saw it happen to Spec Ops. I mean, they've even spoken to it as developers of how, you know, they use a pretty strong language about how it wasn't right. It wasn't, you know, it was a distraction. It took away from the game. And it wasn't, you know, how could you have this serious narrative that they wanted, which enters another line of the discussion of if you have a game that has a single player experience that seeks to develop some kind of connection with the audience, how faithful to that do you have to be when you go to multiplayer?
I'm always fascinated by this question because there are instances where I feel it's completely violated the single player and other times where it's like it doesn't seem to fit, but I somehow am able to allow it to stand apart. I think a lot of it has to do with the quality of the multiplayer and the inventiveness, or if they're trying to add some element into it that gives it, you know, kind, you know, Bioshock 2. You know, I don't really care much for that multiplayer, but I felt that they really had made an effort to do something that respected the Bioshock universe. You know, whereas there's an example in my head I just can't think of where there's been multiplayer where it's like that is just multiplayer that is skinned with characters from the single player game I just had.
Yeah, I thought that you remember when Fear brought in multiplayer in Fear 2?
Yeah.
And it just was and Fear 2, surprisingly, I mean, I know a lot of people poke fun at me for having liked Fear 1 and Fear 2, but I think that both those games were fairly, I liked them. They were good shooters.
I liked
shooters.
Fear 1.
Fear
so
1 was
two.
Better. Fear 2 was, yeah.
Fear 1 was technically a Marvel, but it was the best looking warehouses I had seen in a game that year.
Best warehouses ever. Yeah.
Such great, terrible lighting in those warehouses.
Marcus Beer will probably be yelling at me about saying this in a week. I think Fear 2 at least had a better sense of what they about the game, about the mythology, and it got a lot richer.
Right, but you remember they were like, so they pushed their way into multiplayer, and then remember there was that window about a year where they were working on Fear Warfare or whatever it was. They were going to do like an online, like Fear the online shooter multiplayer game, and it to me remains one of those strongest examples of just trying to force multiplayer out of something that didn't.
Oh, yes. I think I just want to just like think a bit higher level in terms of single player versus multiplayer. Like, my frustration was tacked on multiplayer, especially in primarily single player experiences, that, you know, a single player story, a game, is sort of like a book or a movie. You know, you can, you know, no matter how many of these come out, you sort of just, you can consume them. You know, you want a brand new story, you want a brand new experience. But multiplayer, on the other hand, it's more like a sport, you know? You play
Call of
Duty.
It's like pick up basketball.
Yeah. Tend to play one sport.
Yeah, and you play a long time. And all these publishers are going after this very dedicated market, but a market that's like, it's just so, it's, you know,
and it's all for the purpose of trying to inhibit the resale of the game, you know, a GameStop as a used sale. And yeah, it's just, to me, it's this aspect of the game industry that looks way too much like the music industry 15 years ago. The used game sales, until you go all digital, are going to happen. And this idea that you should be investing all this capital in making multiplayer, when, yeah, there's no proven track record that just having multiplayer something is going to prevent the resale. It has to be good multiplayer, and that's about 1 out of 10 at best in a given year. It's so myopic that's when I have some pause for where the industry is going in terms of the traditional $60 retail games. Because, I mean, I don't know how many times they have to stick their hand in the damn fire to realize that it's hot. You know, I'm happier with like kind of the DLC stuff that's happening. You know, Borderlands 2 is doing it. Those are more effective ways, I think, to get people to not resell the game, and it puts the burden of the best part of the game having to be good enough that people don't want to give it up.
Does the type of longevity that multiplayer brings, people are willing to take risks and people are willing to put the money there, even though that's not in the wheelhouse, say like a BioShock.
That's just because you're a Modern Warfare 3 player.
I am, and it's. I mean, I've been playing the game all year. Yeah, that's the thing. But it's people are willing to take risks to get that multiplayer out, just in case something catches fire, which is a terrible way to go about it. But
you can't live life like that. I mean, that's the problem.
Seems like people are doing it and failing, and the backlash.
Name a competitive shooter multiplayer of the past 5 years. That has any kind of sort of standing out there,
other than Call of Duty. Nothing.
I mean, the three that pretty much dominate: Gears of War, Call of Duty, and Battlefield. You know, and there's a reason why somehow nothing else can take that place.
Halo had a great.
Oh, Halo! You're absolutely right. Halo. So sorry. Yeah.
I'm not sure what Halo. I haven't heard.
Oh, you're such a dude.
But I mean, it's just like, and
you're such an Xbox gamer.
You're such a Modern Warfare clone.
when you look at those four games, you don't feel that there's a vacuum that needs to be filled with yet another shooter that can somehow. No. I mean, they offer enough distinction of play, and they clearly are perfected, and they have a core audience. It's just you have to kind of concede defeat and find another way to keep people from trying to resell their game.
Well, I tell you what I told Ryan the other day when we were shooting the daily and we were looking at footage, and this is like. Was that a week ago or 2 weeks ago when they had the final content drop for Modern Warfare 2?
Oh, yeah. It's a couple weeks ago, probably.
And I'm, like, looking at this map, and I'm watching these guys. And then I'm like, I get it. Okay, there's a couple of these maps that look kind of cool and all. But watching all that going again, I actually thought to myself, we might be at that point where I've Modern Warfare'd. I mean, I have Modern Warfare'd, and I have Modern Warfare'd, and now I've had a year of content to Modern Warfare, and you didn't feel that same way. So it's interesting because there's still that gradation of how much into the series are you.
Right. And just like Andrew said, it's my pickup basketball. It's something I can go and that competitiveness and just go and have a good time, 25 minutes, boom.
Are you gonna pick up Black Ops 2?
Yes. Definitely will.
And then when you pick up Black Ops 2, are you going to continue playing Modern Warfare 3? Or
I go back and forth, actually. Okay. I've gone back to Black Ops. And
that's what I'm really curious about. Like, Call of Duty is just such a massive franchise, but like, how much cannibalization is there amongst fans that like just refuse to move on to the next
iteration? Clearly what Activision is trying to do, I think they're trying to do it a little later in the process than I think they should, but that you're going to have Black Ops loyalists and you're going to have Modern Warfare loyalists. They are trying to create more distinct experiences so that those two brands indicate something very, very clear. They should have done it about 3 games ago and started this kind of dual branching.
It's all leading up to a pay per view for Black Ops versus Modern Warfare.
They're very similar.
In a cage match.
There's nuances between the games, and that's kind of and all the communities are healthy, and there's a lot of people playing, so you can go back. I can go back to Call of Duty Modern Warfare, the first one, and there's still a ton of people playing, and it's like still fun.
I mean,
it's crazy.
You know what's the saddest thing though? When you play a multiplayer game and you're just waiting. You're just waiting. It's an empty lobby. And think about how
need,
many...
Need four players.
Like, think, like, what's a random... Inversion. I'm sure Inversion had multiplayer, right?
Like, I'm sure it did.
You just made me think that there's some guy who still thinks someone's going to play Phantasy Star Online with him. And it's just like, maybe one day they'll show up. It's just this horrible, like, Beckett-like experience, just waiting for just two other people to show up so they can go shoot monsters in a boring fashion.
But when they do show up, it's a match made in heaven.
Yes.
It really is.
Oh, this is scary. You would think, though, that there's so much writing on the wall, you would think that people would snap to this. There's no place that it's more evident than in the MMO world. You know, look, this past week we watched Terra, which Jeff Cannata, and by the way, Jeff is off practicing for a play, but we do have his football picks, so don't worry, we still
is
have
it like
that.
Chekhov? I think he'd be great in the Seagull. Okay, no, he's
doing what's it called? He's doing Noises Off.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
No, I can perfectly see him in that.
So he's excited for that. And it's down in Orange County, and it starts in the middle of September. It's a very rigorous rehearsal schedule. So he's got like 10-hour rehearsals, 6 days
a
week.
It's a very physical play.
Because of all the backstage stuff? And
yeah, I mean, it's wow. Well, please tell him hello.
So he and I both really enjoyed Terra. which is the action-based MMO that was quite risky. It was out in Korea for quite a while, and it was under development and then out way ahead of the time it was out here. And a group called En Masse picked it up for North America. And rather than just slap a localization on it, like English, and then throw it out, they spent a lot of resources going in and retooling quests and reworking the leveling system and trying to make it a more WoW-like experience, because obviously the Korean MMOs are known for their grinding and, you know, that sort of like go and you know, one hand and cigarette in one hand and mouse in the other hand and playing for hours and hours and hours. So the thing about Terra that was very cool, obviously, was you can go back and listen to us talking about it. Like you could sit on your couch and play with a controller, and the combat system was really, really engaging. It was really fun. Now, the narrative and all that kind of stuff was maybe not quite there. Adam's smirking.
I didn't play much of it at all, but it was just...
It was pretty, too. Jeff loved the way it looked.
It was good looking, but the thing is, it was just, okay, we've seen this fantasy setting before. And yeah. It's just, I'm going back, because it was Richard Garriott that brought over, what was the other MMO? We're talking years and years and years ago. I think it was a Korean MMO.
Lineage.
And, you know.
I didn't know he was responsible for bringing it over, but it was probably not the best idea to bring Lineage over ever.
There's this really weird thinking that what's good for the goose is good for the gander when it comes to Asian MMOs. And when you think about it, okay, it's such a different situation when you're looking at these Asian countries. You have, well, except for China, smaller populations. You have more homogenous populations, and you have more of a sense of national pride about these products that are made in that very country. So when you see something like Terra that could do very well, and Lineage definitely, that does very well in Korea, this really kind of strange one-to-one assumption that, hey, this must have some secret sauce that's going to resonate perfectly in an entirely different culture with an entirely different market. And that my first thought of Terra is, I really like this combat system. How am I ever going to know this combat system exists in a game that looks like so many other fantasy MMOs that are out there?
Well, and I think you nailed it by the allusion to secret sauce, because they all see WoW as the Big Mac, and they look at Blizzard down there cranking out the numbers, and even with a drop in subscribers, there's still such a behemoth as far as subscriber number and the amount of income that generates that publishers look at that and go, "Wow, if we could get on that, if we could have that same sort of addictive quality, we would be set. It would be great."
It's like trying to chase Call of Duty in the multiplayer.
It's exactly what I'm talking about. Yeah, that's why I was... And the sad thing is that we keep seeing these failures in the MMO world that just cannot reproduce it, because people get hooked on one thing and then they don't want to escape it, or they slide back to it. So Terra has... They're merging servers, and this is a really dramatic merge. They're going from 11 North American servers to 3.
Wow.
Oof.
To 3. That's one PvP server, one PvE server, and one role-playing server. And that's it. That's the whole game now.
Now, how is Guild Wars doing?
So Guild Wars has had a tremendous launch. Guild Wars, as a matter of fact, if you saw this past week, they had to briefly cease selling digital keys off of their site just to handle the amount of player load and concurrency. So you could still pick up the game by going to another retailer like Amazon or whatever, but they stopped issuing their own keys for a little while. So they're doing great. Now, their model is interesting in that it's buy it for a retail $60, and then that's it. There's no subscription.
Either that model or free to play. I think this middle of the road, you know, way of approaching it is just, it's like, you're asking for a lot of faith on the part of the consumer. And I think that, you know, most consumers realistically have had those promises broken. Yeah, they just don't feel that it's what they thought they were having.
Well, and I was sitting in the car the other day, and I was relaying this story to Ariel, and I was like, hey, you know what? Terra was really pretty. I still have it installed. If the thing were free to play, I certainly would have turned it on since the first month.
Yeah.
Would I have turned it on and made a microtransaction? You know what? Probably. Because probably what would have happened is, on some weekend, I would have decided, oh, I want to play this. And I would have played it a little bit, and if I liked it enough, then if it had had the right transaction, sure, I would have spent a couple bucks to keep playing it, but I'm not going to keep pounding like whatever it is, $12 monthly into it just to keep a server act, just to keep a character active.
But is that enough for them to keep
it? It is if they have a lot of people and they're all playing, dipping in and out, because I'm not really much of a load on their infrastructure either. You know, if I just dip in and play here and there, it's not like they have to like add server space for me or a whole lot of customer support or anything. Like, they've got the game up and running. They've got the servers out there. If there are millions of Miis who drop in and spend a few bucks here and there, and then whales, because keep in mind, in the free-to-play world, it's the whales that keep those games running. You know, but if they've got a bunch of Miis and some whales, and then the Miis out there are saying, oh, yeah, I'm still playing Terra, which keeps the game viable. It right. keeps people coming into it. It also keeps it viable for the whales. Then you've got something that might work.
How many Us will there be when there's literally hundreds of free-to-play?
I don't know. That's games, the other thing is there can't be hundreds, right? I mean, how much further can they go?
I mean, I think we're also seeing the same problem in the mobile space. It's like, okay, we're hitting Atari levels of, like, confusion and like verge of bottoming out. I mean, I always like, yeah, it's just they're it's just the model can sustain itself, but it's so much the Wild West right now that, you know, something's kind of got to sort of be the guiding light about how all the stuff can work, because everyone's just it's a little chaotic out there.
I mean, you know, think about like how angry people got when Square released what Final Fantasy Dimensions for like $20 on iOS. But you know, I was like, wow, we're like, you know, if that released on 3DS or Vita, we'd be like, oh yeah, that's a pretty good deal, you know. But the thing is, I think the expectation now is that, like,
for the iTunes store,
yeah, that, or just on any mobile device, that we don't want to pay for anything.
No. It's you know, look at a problem like the LA Times and the New York Times has. You know, their websites, their newspapers were free online for years and years and years, and then they're like, okay, now we kind of want you to pay for it. And it's like, well, no, you didn't say that only the first hit was free. It's like, yeah. You know, no one is thinking that far ahead when they're making these decisions and they're jumping into this space.
And then you end up with something like the Huffington Post, you know, where
it is free from the outset. They're going to follow that model all the way.
Yeah. But then, you know, what's the hit, you know, on journalistic integrity and quality, you know, compared to something like the New York Times?
Yeah, exactly. No, exactly.
And so... You know, at least I feel like personally we see like the bar is just going lower and lower and lower, and free to play sort of scares me in that.
Really?
I feel like that's going to be it's going to be like the Atari, like, you know, where it's, well, you know,
I think the other issue is there is that assumption, and this kind of works with what you're saying, is that when it's free, okay, I'm going to put up with kind of lower quality, or that there's going to be some issues here.
But I think we've eroded that. I mean, there are very top quality free to play games that are available now.
Yeah. I mean, look, DC Universe Online, Sony's decision to make that thing go free was perfect. I mean, and
perfect
now, like,
for that audience too.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, those servers are clogged all the time.
League of Legends.
Yeah,
I mean, that's the big example.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably the best examples of it. I'm just going back to Guild Wars 2. Mm-hmm. How does that model work though? If they're relying upon the initial retail sale, going in perpetuity, how do they shore up their back end?
That's what I was wondering.
The way they did Guild Wars, they did the old school PC route. They sold expansion packs.
I thought the original Guild Wars was free to level 20. Am I thinking of a different game?
You might be thinking of a different game. Well, it might have only been 20, but then they sell expansion packs. And so the expansion packs give you new levels and new areas. And so they did the classic role-playing game strategy. Here's a big game. Play what you want of it, and then you're hooked on it, you like it, and then they sell you an expansion pack.
I mean, it's fascinating because it puts the burden on the developers to continually put out content. It has to be content of quality. I mean, it's a very interesting model. If it works... God, I really
hope
it works.
But it alleviates them the subscription model of having to get appropriate – of a very murky picture of, well, how much return do I need to get on all this content drop that I'm doing in the next set of patches, you know, in order to justify the amount of dev team I have working against it?
Yeah.
That's got to be really tough to figure out, right? It's like, oh, I'm servicing Terra, so how much more content do I need to push out month after next to keep – my players playing and happy, to give them enough game that they're happy with what they're playing, but I'm pulling in $12 monthly from each of them, which adds up to this much. Like, would it be better off if I had just sold them the game and kept the servers running, and then 2 months, 3 months later came back with expansion pack, I sold it for $20?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, a lot of the traditional model for MMOs kind of follows, you know, like, what was it? Was it the interest-only loans? Like, that stuff that got everyone in so much trouble with the mortgage crisis, where it's all predicated upon the assumed value of the property, and you're leveraging that without any demonstration if that value is really there yet.
Well, you know, the interesting thing to see will be what happens with Terra going this way. Secret World still trying to carry on in a subscription model. They've retrenched. Both those studios have also lost a number of folks. There was a new study from the NPD out called Gamer Segmentation 2012, the new faces of gamers, that included some data on microtransaction and additional content. And one of the things that was a takeaway from this that I thought was interesting was that NPD analyst Anita Fraser, who frequently speaks for them on video game topics, was, you know, she was unsurprised by a slight, one of the things that came out was there's a slight decline in the number of gamers in the United States. 12 million fewer gamers this year than last year. 12 million. They just stopped gaming.
It's hard to believe.
Stop playing. We can talk about that in a second if you want. But
they're all just reading Twilight. And
exactly.
50 Shades of War.
Anita noted that it's the revenue contribution of the core gamer, which is great that she points out the strength of the core gamer, because so often now we hear about how big the rise of social is in the casual gamer. She says it's the revenue contribution of the core gamer segment that continues to outpace all other segments and remains vital to the future of the industry. And the data that supported this was that core gamers over a 3-month sampling period here spent $65 on physical games over that 3-week period. Gamers, the average for all of their sample was $48. So you're about $20 higher, which is significant on that number. And they also were much more engaged in microtransaction and additional content. You had 14% buying microtransactions across gamers, but 27% who considered themselves core gamers. So there are definitely core gamers moving into free-to-play. Obviously, there's a great opportunity for people to get involved. So core game, micro, like free-to-play games are not going to just stay casual games. Why are we still having this argument? World of Tanks.
World of Tanks.
World of Tanks.
There's nothing casual about
World of Tanks.
In fact, the name alone, I think, just makes the case like this isn't for the Angry Birds player. This is called World of Tanks. It is a World of Tanks.
In a there. World.
And no other people. Just
and I think that's a great example of how rich that system can be, because, you know, and I realize that, you know, maybe not a lot of you follow World of Tanks. World of Tanks had a huge engine upgrade about a month ago, and the like substantial update in visual fidelity, and it also impacted sight lines and the physics in the game, or not, you know, at least the gameplay, because of what you could see and the ability to do better transparencies and more smoke and denser foliage and all those things that play into the game. And that's a game that's, again, they're servicing that game as a free-to-play game because their whales are supporting it. And everybody who wants to play free is playing free. And then there are other people who, you know, can drop in and like buy a tank and keep playing. And then they go away for a while and they come back.
I guess going back to the data you just said, I mean, does Nintendo get entirely different data? Because, I mean, that's what I have assumed is going on.
That's North American data.
That's
why Nintendo won't look at it.
I mean, it's just like, it just leaves me banging my head into the table that, you know, I'm not, the core is where the attach rate to consoles comes from, and the attach rate is one of the most important things you want to have in the second half of the life of your console when people are buying games and unless people are buying your actual console. And I just, you know, unless something happens next week at this Wii U event, I mean, I don't see where the pitch is being made to that core gamer that is going to be the bulk of their revenue in the beginning and at the end of the cycle of the console.
They should hope that this NPD report is, you know, small sample and maybe not completely indicative of everything, because the anchor of that drop was family and kid gamers. Family and kid gamers noticed the most substantial drop over the period of this recording. They were like, core light PC and avid PC were down a little bit. Mobile and digital were up a little bit. But family and kids, greatest drop of all.
Yeah, I mean, because there's a reason it's called casual. You don't casual. Have a relationship with it, you know? It's why you screw someone and you forget their name because you weren't planning to see them again. That's what casual gaming is. And it's just, I don't understand. It's in the name. Oh,
so will that start disappearing?
I mean, I think the thing is, well, A, when it's bad economy, if you're casual, you're going to find a way to sacrifice that. If it is a core hobby, you will accommodate other aspects of your life to ensure that you still have the ability to do that.
Your priorities.
You know, and then, you know, parents and kids are still going to be a funny relationship with the comfort of video games, you know, because they want to make sure their kids are getting exercise. They want to make sure that their kids are, you know, getting an education. Most responsible parents don't allow for games to become a centerpiece.
No, you're right. Yeah.
And, you know, and even Iwata had to say, could you please stop babysitting your kids with a 3DS at a restaurant? Which I find to be one of those appalling things. It's like, look your kids in the eye and talk to them when you're eating with them. I don't know. That's me.
Agreed.
That's excellent point for us to take a little break on. When we come back on the other side, thanks to the miracle of smartphones, I have some other NPD data. Yes, I have the August NPD sales figures with a couple of surprises in the software. I haven't really figured out how to process this. We will talk that through. We're also will pick up that sleeping dogs conversation when Weekend Confirmed wraps up in our final segment when we come back. You can tell we were pulling for this title that finished number one in the August 2012 top 10 games list. Darksiders 2. Nice win for Darksiders team. Congratulations.
Hey, congratulations, THQ.
Yeah, THQ.
You haven't done that in a while.
Yeah, your THQ will still be open for at least a few more months.
Well, we don't actually know the numbers. We haven't had a chance to go and look. However, part of the analysis did, Anita did note that the dollar number year over year stabilized finally. So we did not lose. We did not in the HD gaming space, which of course is 360 and PS3 and PC. We didn't lose money. And that also that August, we actually had great new titles in the bin for 2012, which had been one of the things we'd suffered over 2011 was we had not had new releases.
It was late in August. If you think about it, I mean, was that the second to last week of August that
Darksiders 2?
Darksiders 2 came out?
It was the like 17th or so. It's like middle of month.
Okay, I mean, that's still just a couple of weeks of sales, not all 4 weeks. I mean, I think makes it equally impressive.
So they could still do well in this month as well.
Yeah.
Provided they don't get knocked out of there by some of the stuff that's coming in September.
Borderlands 2.
Yep.
Yeah.
That other title you mentioned, Sleeping Dogs, it's not in the top five.
But it was number one in the UK for like 3 weeks in a row.
Sleeping Dogs.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
I know. It's a very...
Well, Square Enix Europe was definitely a lot more hands-on in terms of promoting it.
Yeah. And here in LA, I mean, Borderlands 2 is starting to take over, but like you couldn't, you know, swing a dead cat without hitting a Darksiders 2.
Oh.
Yeah, it was very, very aggressive marketing, and maybe it wasn't as big in the UK, and Sleeping Dogs got a lot of support.
I don't know
there.
Why you're swinging a dead cat, though. I'm just...
Well, I mean, if you have one, what else are you going to do with
it?
I mean, it's like,
you
know.
I'm going to try that out when I get home.
They're weighted balanced, so it's nice.
Yeah.
I mean, so... I wouldn't think that the next one was a surprise. Coming in second was New Super Mario Bros. 2 3DS. Great finish, of course, in the way the NPD does now, their numbers of consolidation. So Darksiders 2 was 360, PS3, and PC. New Super Mario Bros. 2, 3DS only, and came in second for the month. The one that surprised me, the first really big surprise, was the third place finisher, Kingdom Hearts 3D Dream Drop Distance.
It's Kingdom Hearts 3D.
Did people get fooled by the Kingdom Hearts 3?
D.
I mean, it's
another Kingdom Hearts side story. It's
I the one that sets up Kingdom Hearts 3.
I once saw.
I want to believe so bad.
And it was a profile of a guy who had collected every edition, every paperback edition of Joseph Heller's Catch 22. And I was like, well, that's just one of the strangest hobbies or collection fads I've ever seen anyone do. But I think Kingdom Hearts is the only thing that's really equitable to that. It's like, oh, well, let me do the same thing all over again in a different device. Okay. Look, Kingdom Hearts 3 probably isn't going to come. You know why? Disney now makes games. Until they get rid of that interactive division, which I think is like hanging on by for dear life, I just...
Well, they let them make another handheld. They let them make another handheld game.
Yeah, because I don't think they're competing in the exact same space. I don't see... if Kingdom Hearts 3 wanted to exist, it would have at least made some, I mean, maybe, I don't know. I would like it to be announced so then people stop asking me about it. Well, you and know. Then ask me, like, I give a shit about Kingdom Hearts.
They're secretly working on that instead of Versus 13 just to piss people off.
They're secret. They're
but
not
what if that's what Versus 13 is? They're fighting or they're versus Mickey and Cinderella.
That would be
looking at the combat system for Versus 13 is pretty much Kingdom Hearts.
Of course, yeah. I mean that was always, well, that's the team, and that was always that's the direction. All right, so Kingdom Hearts 3D Dream Drop Distance done very well, almost makes me interested enough to look into it. But then Adam's joking about all the weird Kingdom Hearts stuff kicks in, and my brain remembers like I don't know. Ariel loves Kingdom Hearts though. She played 2 all the way through. That's a good game.
I played Dark Cloud 1 5 times over before having to put up with another Kingdom Hearts.
Really? Wow. Fourth place, NCAA Football 13. Okay, I guess people were still excited about getting ready. Because give me mind, Madden didn't come out till very late.
That's true.
So it didn't,
I mean, I almost picked it up.
Madden launched last week. So,
right.
Yeah.
So it didn't hit the numbers. Then Lego Batman 2 DC Super Heroes.
Which has been on the NPDs for like forever now, I think. That's this year's Call of Duty.
And then finally, the other two new releases of the month, Sleeping Dogs and Transformers Fall of Cybertron. So Sleeping Dogs sitting down there in sixth spot, that's got to be a disappointment, right?
Both those games, disappointments, right?
I'm more surprised about the Transformers because it's a strong brand, and as the games have been strong in the past, you know, the past few years, that was not... Huh.
Ozzy calls it his game of the year. Hmm. I don't know if he's played many games, but Ozzy's like totally.
Oh, he loves it.
Transformers?
Yeah.
I've heard really good things. Yeah. I haven't sat down to play it yet, but I mean, I've heard these good things. And yeah, I'm a little shocked that. I mean, but the thing is, if Activision doesn't put its full weight in the marketing behind a game, that game doesn't usually even crack the top 10. Yeah.
Right. That just slipped out and. You know, everyone's saying it's great, but
although
I haven't
think it. About it, it is behind a game that Activision passed on, which is Sleeping Dogs.
Yeah, ooh. Yeah. And I'm pretty sure Square Enix did not pay that much to pick that up.
So. Well, it's a strong game. I like it. Yeah. I mean, it really, really surprised me. You know, it was something I wanted to kind of play around with, and I found that it kind of got its claws in me, and I mean, I did everything I could do in that game, and I was just wouldn't. You know, I spent 5 days.
I wish there were more.
Granted, I'm unemployed, so I mean, I was like, oh, I'm not gonna put my pants on. I'm gonna play myself some Sleeping Dogs. And
tough life.
Yeah. Well, the back pain. You gotta get up and walk around when you're playing games, kids. It's just my piece of advice.
So I think that one of the interesting approaches to talking about Sleeping Dogs, which we've talked about a good bit, is number one, we have Andrew who did the review, but Adam, what's cool is that. And this is not often the case for people who do reviews, is not only did you sit down to play the game just for fun, but you also sat down with the mindset from the outset of, I'm going to play this open world game and I'm going to wring every drop of game from it.
I mean, once I found it to be playable, you know, and like, you know, to be honest, because of like some of the other GTA games, I've always liked the GTA games, but I also have an anxiety about them because the driving is something I cannot get my head wrapped around, like the way that the physics work and that there's so much challenge that's put on your ability to kind of circumnavigate all the issues with that physics, that once I knew that these cars are really fun to drive around, I'm like, okay, cool. And the best is it has clear upgradable elements to your character. So now it's saying, look, there's an invest. You can invest yourself in doing side missions and all these other things that's outside of just getting an achievement. And I, you know, and the fact that the combat was so complex, I mean, everything just kind of dovetailed into itself that I was like, I'm going to try to do everything because there's something in my satisfaction of playing the game that's going to come out of it. And I think the ultimate trick in the game is similar to Saints Row the Third. You're never doing one thing for too long. Like it knows not to outstay its welcome in the various challenges.
I was really impressed that they, throughout the game, they just constantly introduce new mechanics into the storyline.
Yeah.
You know, the first time you hijack a car by like jumping onto it, Pursuit Force style, I'm like, wow. And then you do it, you know, a few more times. Yeah, and you're totally right. You know, nothing really overstays its welcome. You know, the combat gets a little repetitive after a while.
I mean, when you're trying to do all the missions where you just beat up drug dealers, And it's like, okay, I was doing that. I can get a little OCD. I'm like, okay, I'm going to do all my side missions before I do a main mission. And I think a lot of developers need to kind of realize, I don't think I'm unique in wanting to play that way. Like, you want to kind of like clear your board and then you can give yourself the fun of the story mission. That it wasn't as bad in Sleeping Dogs as in other games, but indicate to the player if they're really able to do a certain thing at a certain time in the game. Because, you know, I was like, okay, I'm going to go beat up the drug dealers. I'm like, ooh, there's 20 of them. Okay, hold on. Like 18 of them have knives, and they're stabbing me. And it's like, obviously the game knows what the level is and how it progresses in the story. Does it always need to unlock things? I mean, yes, you can do it if you're at incredibly high level. But it was my biggest issue with Arkham City, is that it didn't help you prioritize what you're supposed to be doing. They kind of just play 52 pickup, threw you out there, and here's all these Joker, you know, challenges, and it doesn't even help you indicate if there's something you don't even possess in the game yet that's going to make this solvable.
The indicator is failure.
Yeah. Or but the thing is, the one thing
no,
you should...
No, it might not be failure, because maybe it's just your skill is not... Like,
right, that's the thing.
So you don't know.
You should never create this for the player, especially in the first couple hours of a game, that they're uncertain if, because they haven't advanced far enough in the game, they can't do something, or somehow they have not gotten their head wrapped around one of the core mechanics of it. I mean, you got to get them confident really early on, and then you sort of ease them into that. I think Sleepy Dogs did that beautifully, and that it just always added a new element, and it had you practice it just the right way so you could put it into effect.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that it starts with the parkour sequence,
yeah.
I was like, oh, I wasn't expecting that. And I'm like, oh, this game actually has a lot more than just being a GTA clone, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it feels, I mean, especially the missions themselves feel so distinct from a GTA mission that really it's, I'm in an open world and I can drive a car around. That really, I mean...
What makes them feel so distinct?
Hmm?
What makes them feel so distinct and different?
Because you're using melee combat and you feel like there's more skill than whack-a-mole. The way that they would progress always felt a little more surprising. You know, when you have the driving mission, it isn't, oh, don't scratch this. It's like it feels more organically integrated.
I think there's only one, like, drive to this point than, you know, drop someone off mission in the entire game, you know? And there's a lot of those in Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah, that sounds amazing that there's only one. Yeah. That sounds great.
You know, we talked to one of the things that came up last week that struck a chord with a lot of folks was this idea of hand-holding, because Jeff and I were talking about Guild Wars. And Guild Wars ostensibly is a relatively straightforward MMO. You've got a task bar at the bottom. You've got a familiar 3D environment that you're clicking in. So there's a lot of things that make sense, right? There's also, though, a number of things that they do that are a little different systematically. Mm-hmm. Not stuff that is like narrative or understand the quest, but simply here's a different wrinkle in how we approached our combat skills, and here's a different way that we approach doing this or the you know, whatever. And I argued that the game was very jarring because it doesn't do a good job in that first couple of hours of explaining to me how its world works. And a lot of people like get upset because they're like, oh, well, you know, it's an MMO and, you know, part of the fun is just playing it and experiencing it and figuring it out. So, Adam, don't you think you should just play it and experience it and figure it out for
yourself? These are young people with too much time on their hands. I mean, seriously, it's like you need, you know, in adult life, you only have so much time that you can really give over to games. And I'm a guy who's professionally supposed to be playing in games, and I still don't feel like I have the luxury of the time to do that. I do not want to feel like the game is wasting my time. And as a business thing, that is not the best thing that you do to your players. You've got to make them understand what they're doing. And I think one of the interesting things with Guild Wars 2 is it sounds like it's a game that kind of pretends that World of Warcraft doesn't exist. You need to kind of acknowledge people are going to be looking at your game through the rubric of the most popular MMO out there. And without having to acknowledge World of Warcraft, you need to probably address your distinctions pretty early on.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Yeah.
They think that you're just going to soak up and understand what's cool about it, as opposed to recognizing that, hey, Pepsi tastes like this, but we taste like Coke.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, most people who are playing Guild Wars 2 right now have probably spent some time playing World of Warcraft or something that's very, you know, very derivative of World of Warcraft. Just come on. Just say like, hey, you probably played another MMO. We do things differently.
That's a really interesting point, because part of the arguments for the you don't need your handheld thing go from, well, you've played MMOs if you're playing this game, so clearly you have an idea of how to get into it. So isn't it much more fun for you just to go in and play the game and figure it out by figuring it out? And I hadn't thought about it from a standpoint of even if you're just playing it, even if you take that approach, then you're missing the opportunity as a game like designer or a game sale, like a game producer, to say, hey, Ryan, you know that part of World of Warcraft that you've done a billion times? We're a little different, and here's why you're going to enjoy doing it this way, because it's different and like this.
Yeah.
That would be, that's a really interesting
point. I mean, it's how a salesman would sell you a car. Say, hey, you probably have driven a Chevy, but if you look at this, you know, this whatever it is in front of me, you would say, like, hey, it's going to be different here.
I mean, like I said, Sleeping Dogs starts with a parkour sequence, not a car chase or you know, a shootout or something that you would expect from a GTA clone. And, like, immediately it sells itself as something different, and I think that's so important.
What was it like getting in and playing like all the side quests and stuff? Because I don't think I've ever had the luxury of playing an open world. I don't remember the last time I played an open world game where I actually just like, you know, luxuriated in playing all of the side quests.
I mean, it's this one was worth it. I mean, usually in a lot of open world games, side quests, like, you might get a little money out of it, and what you're probably going to end up doing is using up all of your bullets that you really are going to need for a main story mission, or you're going to be sent to the hospital five times. So inside missions, you don't get the penalties for death. It's only death that happens when you're kind of in the outside world. You know, it takes money and experience. Just like in GTA. But because you have experience and you can upgrade your moves and some of your defenses, there's a real sense of reward. Like, hold on, I really can get something out of this. And like I said before, they don't overstay their welcome. I mean, almost every side quest I could do in 5 minutes. And so it's kind of a fun thing to experiment with that has a clear objective and isn't trying. I mean, the game seems committed to making you finish it. Which I find very, very interesting about Sleeping Dogs. They just don't throw in, like, the, you know, the third act, like, obstacles where they spike the difficulty, or they completely change, you know, the gameplay. I mean, it was fun to do the side missions because it's just the core mechanics were just satisfying to use.
I feel like we talked about it up and down mechanically, so we can kind of leave that behind. But they also had really high aspirations to deliver a cinematic experience. And I don't think anyone, I don't even Jeff didn't really talk about that much. How did you guys feel about the caliber of the...
Okay, so they're comparing the game, saying it was inspired from Infernal Affairs, right, which is the exceptional, it is a Hong Kong movie.
Yeah.
That you know, inspired Martin Scorsese to put Irish people in and call it The Departed. You would have to tell that to me five times over for me to figure out that it involves an undercover cop. And to that extent, it's like Infernal Affairs. But Infernal Affairs is a dark story about loyalties and things like that. I mean, it's got a story that is, the writing's actually good in the instance. The overall package, it's like, this is kind of like grade C Hong Kong, you know, film. And I think actually what might have made it work is if it actually followed some of the Hong Kong films more, with some really bad singing sequences and some of the overwrought emotions, like those things that are kind of really soapy that are right, endemic to the Hong Kong things. I think it would have given it a sense of distinction. It's just kind of a highly, you know, just concentrated, you know, okay, double cross, I don't like you. And the acting in the moment is good, but the overall is quite forgettable.
I mean, it's definitely a story that was scripted just to get you going from mission to mission to mission.
Okay. That's kind of what I wanted to know. And that's not the end of the world, especially not given the things that you guys pointed out, like how would you enjoy the driving, how the side missions are quick and digestible and keep on point, and that's actually very...
As you were talking about earlier, the gameplay takes precedence in this one, and that actually is not typical of a lot of open world games.
Yeah, no, it's like they tend to take their story almost too serious. It's like, we built this open world, but by the way, we want you to really be focused on
that. Or the same sort of the third, it's like, if we have enough funny in here, you might not notice that not everything works perfectly. Yeah.
Wait, I thought everybody loved Saints Row the Third.
I love it, but come on, there are times where I was just like, oh my god, the helicopter.
I didn't play Saints Row the Third. Everyone tells me I should play it.
Some of it is so much fun, but then it's just like, oh, okay, things that we need to stop. No more helicopters and no more swimming. Until someone figures out how to do it right and they can license that to everybody else that plans on using it, we need to just kind of just sit on our hands. We're not writing previews anymore like it's so novel that there's a freaking helicopter in a game. Yes, that was incredibly cool 10 years ago. You don't need to have them anymore.
I'm especially with you on the swimming. With you on the swimming.
Just die. Have my character die. That's fine.
That is not a successful thing. Swimming hardly ever works.
Yeah.
All right, so before we get to finishing moves, I'm going to completely change gears. Coming out here in a couple weeks is a game that both Ryan and I have played that I know a lot of people are anticipating, FIFA 13, which I got to play last night with Al over at my place. And we were both like, we played it a little bit at E3. We were both blown away by how much difference just the first touch difference makes.
Oh, it's harder.
It's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, it's very different, which every year it's always very different, and every year it's always great, which is amazing, which I don't understand how they do it every year, but it is difficult. That first touch, you have to know your players and know how good they are or what they do.
So for those of you who are interested in football, soccer, football, and
football,
and don't know first touch right off the bat, it's this idea of the importance of the first touch of the ball when it comes into a player and controlling it, and how the rest of the flow of play then really comes based off of how well that player is able to get that first touch. And in prior versions of almost basically every soccer game, you had every player on the pitch making amazing touches. Like the ball,
they were just magnets.
Yeah, they're like, yeah. It led to the whole ping pong thing,
sticky
right?
Feet.
And so you would just like, and one thing I learned last night is how guilty. Even though I thought I was like a cool FIFA player. No, obviously I was a ping ponging son of a bitch.
No zigzagging down the field.
Now,
quick.
How was it integrated? I mean, that almost sounds like overwhelming, but it sounds like you guys are really into it.
You see it. You literally see it. Like, Adam, like, the ball goes flying towards your player, and you see, because you can see the articulation of his limbs and his body, you can see the manner in which he's trying to control the ball, and you can see how well he does based off of where the ball goes
now,
when it hits
him. Right. Do you have any guidance as to trying to get that best first touch in terms of just kind of delicate movement on the analog stick?
Well, you have to ease it in, and if your player isn't as talented, you have to hit the ball catch it.
Your player's talent is a big part of it. What he's talking about there is like, so a player who is very talented with his feet, you're trying to run him down, he's going to be able to, a guy who's like good at like bringing balls down with his chest and getting them down and under control of his feet, it's very good.
Yeah.
But another knock on to this is it suddenly becomes very important to keep the stick like centered a lot and get the ball underneath you because you really need to control over it. Whereas before, like you could like pretty much just jam the stick and then be like pass, jam the stick. You have to really be more thoughtful and conscientious of control of the ball.
Now, right. What about, like, you know, I think a lot of people know that, especially on 360 controllers, it can have that drift. are we talking about, like, you have to have a pretty pristine controller to be able to get the best performance out of this game?
I wouldn't say that.
Mine wasn't that bad.
Yeah, I played on 360, and I'm playing at work against Spencer, who's one of the interns, and he's amazing at this game.
He's ridiculous.
Don't you hate it when the interns are that much better than you?
Ridiculous.
He works 20 hours a week. I'm like, you know, get out of here.
Get out of here. You bother me.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I was playing Madden back in those days, and I was pretty good, just roasting people with full-time jobs. I'm real proud of myself.
what if you want that simpler experience? What if you want, like, the arcade-y FIFA
it's more difficult, but there's definitely more accountability and it's more realistic. So
you can leave all the
assists
on.
Is this going to work for? I mean, it sounds like an admirable thing they've done.
It's and getting sort of farther like, away.
I mean, could this actually alienate that market? I mean, obviously everyone in theory is like, ooh, cool, because they think they're such a good FIFA player. And it sounds like there might be a rude wake-up call to people across this planet.
Yeah, kind of. I had that discussion with my roommate, and I was like, I might like 12 better, and I might think 13 is a better game in a better
like,
representation
like 13
of soccer.
Is better. Yeah. But less fun because you have to like think about it.
Less fun,
I think,
but
it's more fun. I thought like playing against Al, I thought it was more fun because it looked and felt much more like a match of soccer.
That's the distinction.
It was really unpredictable, especially when you're trying to lead. Like it's just so much more open and wild, and especially when you get those counterattacks and like a lot of the midfield play, it gets crazy.
Those type of things are better.
How much do you play online? Do you do most of your FIFA that way, or
actually, I play Madden online, but I tend to play FIFA on the couch, and I think that's because most of the time probably my skill level is just not there. I play FIFA online, and I get destroyed.
Insane.
So
on
my I'll go ahead and put a plug in for him because I love him so much. This restaurant Tironi in my neighborhood here in LA. I mean, it's just incredible Italian food, and have wonderful Italian friends that work there. And man, do they play FIFA. And they only play it online and they play competitively.
That's where
and
you get
this
good.
This is where this is what I'm wondering is that when you have such a competitive worldwide thing that's happening with FIFA as, you know, with the ping pong style, how people are going to suddenly react if that skill, that pride, that bragging right suddenly gets so compromised with a new mechanic.
Yeah, they'll figure out stuff. Mm. I mean, there's like...
Every year.
Yeah, there's guys who figured out all sorts of like ways to, you know, set your formations differently and get set up for just dropping it over the top all the time. And there will be ways. It's a game. So there'll be people who exploit it will be able to exploit it. There are people who are already exploiting Madden games. Like, I'm playing Madden the other night. And like, I kick off to this guy, and he grabs his alternate receiver at the goal line and runs him up into the line. And I figured out why. It's because for some reason, a bunch of my defensive team that's coming down the football field, like, is attracted to him instead of the guy who's actually the ball carrier. I'm sure it's a glitch of some sort.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, that's dumb. I mean, why would you? Like, if you want to break games like that, you can. Back to like the FIFA thing. What's cool is for people who want to play a real like. Soccery game of soccer, I think they're going to find that part is really cool.
It's still FIFA.
You
know,
this game's quite soccery.
Quite soccery.
I wasn't even a huge soccer fan, but since Madden kind of fell off last few years, I've migrated over to FIFA.
It was great. We were playing.
EA Sports is totally okay with that.
Yeah. Apparently.
For those who are curious, we were playing Arsenal and Tottenham last night, so that was very bitter matches back and forth. Very bitter matches. All right, folks, we are going to wrap her up with finishing moves.
Finishing moves.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, and I am going to start her off because since Mr. Kanata is not here, we will not be kicking off a tailgate proper segment. However, it is time for the National Football League. And I do have his picks right here for our season starter. Here are the three games we're picking. Dave, you should be listening because, you know, you do have to pick. And Ryan, you can be our guest picker today if you'd like to.
Great.
We're going to pick Niners +5.5 at the Packers. We're going to pick Seattle -2.5 at the Arizona Football Cardinals. And we're going to do the Monday night game, the Chargers -1.5. At the Raiders. Unsurprisingly, Mr. Kanata is taking the Niners and the points of the Packers. He's taking Arizona at home, and he's taking Oakland at home. I'm going to go out here and say, look, there's no way. Like, sorry, I love you, Jeff. Niners are not going to be the Packers. I'm going to take the Packers. I don't even... 5.5 points is not going to be enough for the Niners. Sorry, guys. Sorry.
You think Alex is going to not outscore...
Yeah,
the Green Bay Packers.
Yeah, I think the Packers are going to come out looking to make a statement in the opening game of the season. Seattle -2.5 at Arizona. That is a really tough game. I have almost no faith in Arizona at all to be able to do anything. I'm gonna take those mighty Seattle Seahawks and give up the points. Dave's like fist bumping right now, I'm sure. And then Chargers at the Raiders. I believe in Run DMC. I'm taking the Raiders. There you go. Mr. Ryan, you can be our guest picker. Where do you want to go on that? Niners +5.5 at the Packers.
I'm going Niners.
Okay.
Because I'm from the Bay, so we'll go
I'm
Niners.
From the Bay. It's like, you know what? If you ever want to give us any credibility, you have to give like a sporting
okay.
perspective.
Well, I'll give my reasoning. I think the Niners D is going to show up huge, and all that needs to be done is Alex Smith to score 20 points. That's all I want from Alex. I've been saying that all last year. Just give me 20.
It's nice to want things.
But we can keep Green Bay under 20. We'll win.
Seahawks -2.5 of the Cardinals.
I'm going to neither. None of these teams. Sorry, Dave.
It's a hard one to pick.
I'm going Seattle because I think they have a lot of potential with that new snazzy quarterback.
They have some potential, right? Secretly the best rookie quarterback in the league.
Right? I'm excited. 5'10"? Love him.
Not really.
But the Cardinals are the Cardinals. That's probably my main reason.
All right, and then a bitter rivalry on Monday night. The Chargers -1.5 at the Raiders.
I'm gonna go with the Raiders because I really like Darren McFadden.
And Run DMC, dude. I'm all about Run DMC.
I think he's a stud if he stays healthy, but... Yeah, and I don't like the Chargers.
All right, Dave, your picks there. Niners, Packers. He's got the Packers, and because he has Aaron Rodgers as his quarterback on his fantasy team. Okay. Seahawks and I know you're taking the Seahawks. Of course, you're taking Seahawks all the way. And then finally, Chargers. Oh, he's with the Chargers. So you got the... Oh, Micah's in this as well. So where's Micah going? He's got the Pack, the Seahawks... And the Raiders.
No,
all right,
Niner
folks.
Love. Come on.
There you go. Our picks are in. You can ridicule us in the forums. And then thanks to everyone also, and a sympathetic apology for those of you who did not get in. I have you know, we got two leagues open for fantasy, tremendous response. And if you didn't see it already in the thread on Shaq, next year I will start off getting the Weekend Confirm Fantasy League set up, and I won't enter other leagues until I have those set up. So we will make sure that next year everyone who wants to play with us will be able to play with the radio team. So that's my commitment to you guys. All right. That's my finishing move. It was a long finishing move, but there you go. No tailgate. Ryan, what's your finishing move?
My finishing move is I've been playing a lot of Madden, so a few games a night. Here and there, but I don't like it. I really don't. I think it's I think it's better than the last 4 years, but it's still the second you get touched, you fall down. You're a rag doll. It's awful. I was a running back in high school, so like you want to put your
A button is your friend, buddy.
I mean, it is. I just don't like it, and I really wanted to. I think it's better, but I'll probably play a whole lot of it, but I don't like it too much.
I think you're already like soft selling it so that like when I beat you, it's not going to be so humiliating.
Oh, no, I'm very good, but I don't like it.
Adam. I'm going to begrudgingly beat you.
Yeah. You know, let's get him set up. Adam, your finishing move, sir.
The other game I've been playing is Darksiders 2. And I'm not going to do a full evaluation. I'm quite enjoying it. I have some issues with some of it.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
But it's a Zelda clone. You know, and there's nothing wrong with that. Now, the thing is, Zelda games are just by nature highly contrived. I mean, like the way the dungeons are set up, the way it's structured, the way they kind of integrate new skills, and then they have challenges to match it, is pretty much a game acknowledging that it's a game. And it works all the time in Zelda because Zelda has such an innate charm that it's just like, yeah, it's like you're just kind of like there, and it's kind of like a compact between the game and the player. I get it. This goes on. It's a little weird when you have an M-rated game and you play death. And it just, you know, I find the game so enjoyable, but it just is almost like this kind of weird discordant elements. Like somebody just put whiskey in my peanut butter, which might actually taste good. And it doesn't like the worst thing, but it's like two things that you really don't, most people wouldn't try to put together.
Whole Foods. They have it at Whole Foods.
Whiskey butter.
See, whiskey butter, I mean, see, that's the two things working together in harmony. And then you spread it on toast. And then I smile.
Someone let us know about whiskey butter. Andrew Yoon, your finishing move, sir.
You know, I've been using my PS3 a lot more lately because of the YouTube app.
Really?
Yeah. I've been using the Xbox a lot for YouTube, but, you know, Sony released YouTube on PS3, and it's just, the experience is just so much better, and I'm sort of,
a video app better on the PS3? No.
I don't know why that like dichotomy always seems to happen where the PS3 gets the better version of the app, but it has this like really cool gimmick where you can pair it with your phone. And at first I was like, oh, that's stupid. But actually, it actually works really well where I'm like, I'm on Twitter on my phone and like I click on a YouTube link and then I just hit a button and I send it to the PS3. And it's like, wow, I'm living in the future now.
That's like AirPlay.
It's AirPlay, yeah.
it's AirPlay.
Which is cool.
And yeah, I've just been watching the DNC speeches on YouTube via PS3.
So that's pretty cool.
And definitely try the app. It's
and PSA, really if you have a Vita and PS3, Eco Shadow of the Colossus remote play patch is out. You can put, obviously your network connection might impact your enjoyment of it, but you can pop that in your PS3 and then, tunnel to it from your Vita, and away you go.
Best way to play Shadow of the Colossus on a 5-inch screen.
It's an OLED screen.
Yeah. Also, yeah, that screen has a higher resolution than the original game did.
Yeah.
Whatever. All right, folks, that is it. Thanks very much to Adam Sessler for joining us again,
sir. Oh, my pleasure.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for Ryan for sitting in here with us.
Awesome.
Big thanks to the Atlantis group here in Santa Monica, as always, for hosting us, and Micah for working the boards, Dave in there for producing and keeping everything running as it ought to. That's it, folks. Till next week, that's your Weekend Confirmed, and we are Ghost.
Damn, what time is it?
I need a drink,
Hangaway. I need a drink,
Alizé.
I need a drink,
Hangaway.
I need a drink,
Champagne.
I can't drink all by myself. I'ma need all of y'all help.
I need a drink,
Absolute.
I need a drink,
Hypnotic.
I need a drink,
Hennessy.
I need a drink,
Gin and Tonic. I can't drink all by myself. I'ma need all of y'all help.
It's only 12 o'clock, but I need another bottle. Cause me and my crew only know.
This podcast is brought to you by Random House Audio. Visit www.randomhouseaudio.com and play something new.